It's just genius writing.
Every time I read it, it was like reading it for the first time.
Featuring Val McDermid, Tamsin Gregg, Emma Thompson and more.
250 years of Jane Austen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And you can catch a dramatisation of Northanger Abbey, a coming-of-age satire on 1790s Gothic literature. Listen now on BBC Sounds. BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday the 6th of December. This is Lisa Costello. Good morning. The Scotland manager, Steve Clarke, has said his side's draw for the Men's Football World Cup next year, which includes a clash with Brazil, is fantastic. England's Thomas Tuchel said his side would be well prepared for a difficult group, including Croatia. They both found out their opponents at a glitzy ceremony in Washington, D.C., and will learn more today about their schedules and the cities they'll play in. From Washington, our sports editor, Dan Roan, reports.
As well as being handed challenging draws, both England and Scotland know they'll be playing games in the east of North America. Which host cities and at precisely what times will be revealed by FIFA at a scheduling announcement later today, but the choices could be crucial. Teams playing in that part of the United States during last summer's Club World Cup faced extreme heat and storm delays. If they win their group, England could face the daunting prospect of Mexico in Mexico City in the round of 16, and then a mouth-watering match against five-time winners Brazil in the quarter-final.
Officials from Washington and Kiev say real progress towards ending the war in Ukraine depends on Moscow showing serious commitment to long-term peace. A second day of talks in Florida has ended with the US and Ukraine agreeing to a framework for post-war security and reviewing recovery projects. Our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports.
Talks about the latest US proposals on the Ukraine war have now stretched across 2 weeks and multiple venues. After a meeting in Florida, Mr. Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff posted an update to X in which he said Ukraine had reaffirmed its position that any settlement must respect its independence and sovereignty. But the party said real progress would depend on Russia's readiness to show commitment to long-term peace. A Kremlin aide has said negotiations between Russia and the US are making progress and mentioned the possibilities of another face-to-face meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin. Talks between Ukrainian and US negotiators will reconvene today in Miami.
Members of the US Congress have expressed concern about Netflix's proposed takeover of Warner Brothers' streaming and studio business worth $72 billion. The deal will need approval by regulators. Critics say it would leave Americans with higher streaming costs and fewer options. The Royal College of GPs says family doctors are having to strike a difficult balance when patients expect a diagnosis for mental health conditions but don't meet the criteria. Hundreds of GPs have told the BBC they think such conditions are being overdiagnosed. Our health correspondent Catherine Burns has more details.
752 GPs took part in our research. 442 of them said that on balance, they believed mental health problems were being overdiagnosed. 81 had the opposite view, that underdiagnosis was the issue. The Royal College of GPs said it was important not to medicalise the full range of normal feelings and behaviours experienced by people, and to ensure GPs were not being pressured into making diagnoses that conflict with their clinical judgement. An independent review is expected to report back next summer.
The celebrated architect Frank Gehry, who designed the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, has died at the age of 96. He was born in Toronto before moving to the US, and Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney praised his unmistakable vision. Frank Gehry's use of industrial materials and sweeping curves helped revolutionise architecture. Cricket and Australia have extended their lead in the second Ashes test in Brisbane, despite England's bowlers taking two wickets. In reply to the tourists' first innings total of 334, Australia a short time ago had reached 447 for eight, a lead of 113. Australia lead the five-test series 1-0. Now with the weather, here's Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, low pressure dominates our weather as we head through the weekend. So particularly today, lots of heavy blustery showers, some strong winds around, particularly in the south as well. So if you are across the southern half of England and Wales too, frequent showers this morning, could be some thunderstorms around too. It is also very windy, particularly close to the south and the west coast. And we're seeing gusts in excess of 50, even 60 miles an hour. There are several flood warnings across the south coast of England through the Bristol Channel and towards Pembrokeshire as well. We could see coastal inundation with those very large waves today. The showers will be hit and miss throughout the course of the day, and it'll be mild with temperatures 11 to 13. The northern half of England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, lots of showers around this morning. It's windy in the northeast of Scotland, but the winds and the showers will gradually ease through the day. So a slightly improving picture, certainly not as windy as it will be further south. And again, mild around 8 to 11 degrees today.
Thanks, Sarah. Now for a look at the morning papers. And the World Cup draw features on several front pages, with the Daily Mirror calling it one hell of a draw, referencing England's group. The Sun says the contest is gonna be tough, as England will face the African nation as well as Croatia and Panama. The paper then says at least we're not Scotland, whose opponents include Brazil. Could it be magic, asks The Guardian, alongside a picture of Robbie Williams performing at the draw. The Daily Star says the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize, awarded to President Trump during the event, was taking the peace. The Daily Telegraph claims allies of the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, are pressing the former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, to join him on a joint ticket to lead Labour. The paper says Ms Rayner would be promised a cabinet role if she backed a future leadership bid by Mr Streeting. A spokesperson for Wes Streeting is quoted as saying the report is a silly season story. A source close to Angela Rayner is reported to say there's no vacancy and no pact. Elsewhere, The Times focuses on comments from Baroness Faulkner, who has just finished her term as head of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. She accuses the government of letting women down over its record on single-sex spaces. Baroness Faulkner says Labour has lost touch with its fundamental values. The government has previously said it wants to ensure women have access to single-sex spaces while ensuring trans people are treated with dignity and respect. Pictures of the Princess of Wales's Together at Christmas carol service feature on the front of many papers. The Telegraph shows the Prince and Princess and their children holding candles and reading from songbooks during the event at Westminster Abbey. The Times headlines its picture, Stars of Wonder. And that's the news, weather and papers this morning. In half an hour here on Radio 4, could rural traditions from Morris dancing to drystone walling and tartan weaving be internationally protected by UNESCO? The government's rounding up an inventory of examples of British living heritage. Will it fly and what would it mean? Farming Today this week will tell us at half past. But now, it's This Natural Life with Martha Carney.
I'm in the Cotswolds for This Natural Life, high up in a common with an amazing view around lots of villages. Behind me I can see some brown and white cows grazing, the red haws of the hawthorn bushes. It's a really beautiful part of the world. And I've come to Gloucestershire to meet a woman who plays a central role in the fight against climate change. She advises the government about whether it's meeting its targets for cutting carbon. Emma Pinchbeck, CEO of the Climate Change Committee. Hi, Emma. Tell me why you've brought me here.
Oh, this is where I grew up and now where I live. And it's also where my husband was from and where we're raising our children. And it's where about 11 generations of my granny's family are from too. So when I think about what we're trying to protect, intellectually, obviously, it's the rest of the UK and the wider world who will be much more vulnerable to climate adaptation and climate impacts. But if I'm honest, this is the sort of beating heart of what I do and the desire to keep this landscape and pass it on to my children.
And it's such a precious landscape. Just describe a bit more of what we can see.
So we're up on top of the limestone grassland, itself a carbon sink actually, one of the UK's rarest chalk grasslands, and it's protected by the National Trust. But it's an escarpment across five interconnected valleys, which make up the five valleys of Stroud and the surrounding area. So rolling hills and valleys with this beautiful grassland on top. mixed woodland, lots of beech turning copper at the moment.
We can see it right on the other side of the valley, yeah. Can't we? It's beautiful.
And we're looking out actually across at two wind turbines, which I've always liked because there's a real mix of old and new here. So it is a beautiful, natural, protected landscape. But all over it, you can see the signs of thousands of years of human history. We're quite near an Anglo-Saxon fort. We're looking across to modern wind turbines where there is an ancient long barrow across on the opposite hill. There's a vineyard back where there used to be a vineyard from monastery in the medieval period.
Just I can on the other see side of the vines, yes, yeah. Sloping down over there.
Excellent wine, can confirm. And then there's also a Roman villa just down on the other side of the valley. So I have always loved this mix of a landscape that feels like it has never changed, that I want to protect, when it obviously has been changed and been here alongside sort of hundreds of thousands of years of humans.
Do you feel like a personal connection with those different generations?
Yeah, I think so. My granny's family used to farm on the flatlands, which we can just see around the bend of the river. And so my family has taken several hundred years to move about 10 miles up the road. And I think there's just this sense of my hands in the soil and generations of my granny's family having done the same thing and all of my childhood memories being connected to here. And I've got two small children of my own now and I watch them running in the landscape and it's so visceral for them, a memory of my brother and I with my grandparents here. Yeah, it's so deeply personal. I'm so connected to this, so it's so much part of who I am as a person. And then coming back to work, there's so much I think in politics at the moment which is about place and identity and what climate change or these big systemic changes mean for somewhere that you know intimately. And although my work is national and the work of the Climate Change Committee is that big picture, for me, it does come back to places like this. I completely understand what it is to be from somewhere, and it's from here.
Well, here is Rodborough Common, so let's carry on walking across the common. So your grandmother was a farmer, was she?
She wasn't, because like a lot of farmers' daughters, her father was determined that she wouldn't be a farmer or married to a farmer. But all of her brothers farmed, and I grew up quite near to the farm that her father farmed, my great-grandfather. He was a tenant farmer, and a lot of that first love of nature comes from things like my granny taking me out to watch the badgers in the Thlad Valley, which is one of the valleys on the other side of here. My grandfather introducing me to the poetry of Laurie Lee.
Did Laurie Lee, the writer, did he campaign for the Thlad Valley?
He did, yeah, and again, coming back to work, there's a lot of conversation about infrastructure on landscapes and things like pylons or the wind turbines, like the ones we can see over there. You know, to decarbonise the economy, we have to build quite a lot of stuff because we needed a lot of clean electricity. It's where most of the emissions reduction are going to come from. And you can see that tension where it's about building infrastructure on landscapes. In the Slad Valley, when I was growing up, I think there was a proposed development of housing. And the locals...
Just to interrupt a moment, we're just by the sound
the cows.
We can hear. These are cows chomping away.
So, yeah, there were huge campaigns growing up around and conversations about what to protect and what to develop. And Stroud has always been a working town, big mill town, the heart of the wool industry in the 18th century. And so building here is not something that people necessarily object to, but equally, we're very protective over the places which are beautiful. And so that ability to have a holistic conversation about the value of nature, what to protect, where to change, the relationship of humans to this environment again, I think we've got a history of that in this place. And I think that, again, is really useful for doing what I do for a living. The cows, by the way, are the reason it stays grassland. So this is a landscape that needs to be grazed. It keeps the grass down and allows the kind of orchids and some of the rare plant species, the thyme and so on, to come forward.
Do you get orchids up here?
We do. It's one of the reasons it's a protected SSI.
Site of special scientific interest.
Yes. And we get Pascal flowers. We get lots of butterflies and they've released the large blue, which is an extremely rare kind of butterfly, over the last 5 years, and they're trying to establish a population of it here. So we try and stay on the paths because most of the areas of grassland are, apart from the cows, protected. And again, such a flashpoint for talking about the role of agriculture in natural landscapes or agriculture in climate change. But as you can see, I'm a big fan of cows in places, and they are absolutely essential, the graziers, to keeping this landscape the way that it should be.
But also emitters of methane, as we know.
Yeah. So we've got cattle grazing on a carbon sink here, and they're essential to keeping the carbon sink flourishing. In terms of, you know, agricultural emissions, in the 2040s, agricultural emissions will be the biggest contributor to carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions in the UK. And so a lot of that does come from cattle. No such thing as a mechanical cow. So what we've done in the carbon budgets is think about how you can continue to have that kind of agriculture and offset it with nature-based solutions, which is scientists speak for trees. So if you look out at this valley, all of that native beech, oak, broadleaf tree species, we're talking about moving from about 13% of the landscape being wooded to being about 16% of this landscape and other landscapes being wooded. And rather than just think about agroforestry to get our trees, we want to see more woodland like this. So right place, right tree, native species. And we do that to allow us to still have cows grazing in the places where they're needed, either for agriculture or, in this case, keeping this beautiful grassland the way that it needs to be. Oh, look.
Oh, butterfly.
That's actually unusually as well. Like a lot of places, I see lots of cabbage white butterflies, but few of the kind of coloured peacocks or red admirals or the ones I can remember from my childhood.
I think that might have been a red admiral.
I think it might have been a red admiral too, so we can have a bit of excitement for that wild-time butterfly.
Well, let's find out a little bit more about how you ended up in your current role. When you were a teenager, did you know that you wanted to work in something connected with the countryside or with the environment?
No, if I'm being honest, although I think I always wanted to do something that was meaningful, like a lot of teenagers, you know, and I always love nature. So, you know, as a school recycling monitor, as that sort of person. And again, my mum, my gran, everyone around me, we had a garden where we grew things, we had chickens. I knew the names of birds and plant species and trees and felt very strongly about protecting this place. The idea that I could do this for work hadn't occurred to me then, but I don't think it's a particular surprise in hindsight. There's a bench on the valley on the other side of this hill where, about 15 years old, my friend from school and I had been, I don't know, thrown outside to entertain ourselves for a couple of hours. And we ended up on this bench looking over the valley, hanging upside down off it, because if it's right on the edge of the hill, you feel like you're flying. I mean, 15 years old in the countryside, that's how we got your kicks. Yeah, pre-phones. And I remember sitting back up and looking at it and thinking, I would do anything, like anything, to keep this place as it is, this moment, this place, all of these memories as they are, and that like bitter sweetness of being, you know, a teenager having profound thoughts, but also a genuine desire to protect something which I felt I'd inherited and to be able to pass it on. And now I've got children, that is an instinct that has never gone away, and that completely underpins the work that I do.
Today for This Natural Life, I'm on Rodborough Common near Stroud in Gloucestershire with my guest Emma Pinchbeck, Chief Executive Officer of the Climate Change Committee.
And then this way is Stroud, which is the big town, or biggish town around here, where the school that I went to is. So you can just see it down in the bottom of the valley. That lovely building behind a tree. And then the town council, which is in a repurposed wool mill, one of the bigger ones. So all through the bottom of this valley are the old wool mills. And generally speaking, they've been turned into offices or homes now. Again, this wave of change through the valleys. So we've got all of the Industrial Revolution here, canal system, mills, the red brick terraces of the Victorian town in Stroud. And I think it partly gives Stroud its iconoclasm. There's lots of protesters, and it's a big community of workers and people that are connected to land because they're from a kind of farming and agricultural community, but are connected to this town because they have ancestors that worked in the mills and that connection. And I think it gives it a real vibrancy. And again, it's that waves of human development and experience and living set in this beautiful agricultural natural valley.
So when you came to leave Stroud after you left school, what was your thought process when you came to decide what to study?
I didn't have anyone that had been to university before me who I could talk to about it in the family. I had no relatives who had a degree to ask, but everyone really prioritised education. So, well, there was a kind of team effort, I think. I sometimes feel like I was a team effort. You know, they could see I was bright and that was something that I wanted to do. And so the kind of arrogance of ignorance, Oxford. And there's something about the garden at Corpus, which is a college I went to, that reminded me of here, a bit wild, cottagey. Corpus was one of the few colleges where you could walk on the lawn. It's small, it felt familiar, it felt cottagey. And in the garden, there's this beech tree and the famous view of the Oxford skyline that you can see from the river with all the spires and the trees. You can see the Copper Beech in Oxford from wherever you take that view. And they're thinking about what happens given the change in climate, because beech is so susceptible to drought. And then I did classics and English because my mum said to me again, with the freedom of having no anticipated outcome for a degree, she said, do something that you're interested in, something that you love. And I am fascinated by, as humans, we find something in common, how we think and feel and relate to each other, how we sit in the land, what we do to it, how we shape it. And underneath it, I think that's why I ended up reading history, classics, and then English, and then literature, because we tell stories about who we are. And in the work that I do and the work the Climate Change Committee does, so much of bringing people with us on the change that is happening and coming for us is about telling good stories.
How do you tell good stories to people living around here who would look across and see wind turbines, or in other parts of the country where they're facing very high pylons to bring offshore wind to the places that need it? It's a big change for people living in the countryside, isn't it?
I think people from the countryside are used to change. You stand here and you look at how much this landscape has been through, and in the course of my life, how much the industries, the communities, the people have changed over. We've built infrastructure. I'm looking at some of it. We're looking at two wind turbines up on the hill. And I can remember those wind turbines being built. They're very early wind turbines. And I remember the community campaigning both for and against them, because they're on the hill above where the house was that I grew up. And I find that debate interesting, because my son, who's three, just treats them as part of the landscape. He calls them the mummy turbine and the baby turbine. So he just sees them as part of what it is to be here, in the way that I see the wool mills or my old school or the developments that I grew up with. And so I've got two thoughts. One, people in the countryside are good at change. We've been changing for a long time. I come from a farming family where we'll change for the weather, for the demands of diet, for the changing environment. I come from a town which has changed for waves of human need. We're actually much better at change than people think. I have no tolerance for this idea that the countryside is preserved in Aspic. That's what tourists think of it. If you're from here, we also want jobs and livelihoods in a community, and that's fine.
But there still are people, aren't there, who will say, we don't want them here. We think it's spoiling the natural beauty of an area. So what do you say to them?
Well, the second part of it is that you have to have a thoughtful conversation. So I start with, this landscape is going to change. You know, half of our top quality agricultural land is threatened by flooding by 2050. We are going to experience warmer summers like the one we've just had, wetter winters like the 18 months we had prior to that. It will change the species that can grow here, the species that can survive here. There's berries on all of the trees like I have never seen, because we've had a really warm year followed by, you know, previously a really wet spring and summer. I worry about the birds that would be expecting those berries later in the season. It's all interconnected and it is changing. You cannot stop it. And the only thing that can help mitigate some of the worst of that change, so we don't lose this, is oddly to change it a bit with clean infrastructure in some places. So I think you have to make the argument that it is about protection, because that's what people around here understand. And then the other things I'd want to know is, does it have to be here? Have you thought about where else it could go? And I also think we can have a conversation about where we don't build. And I think the idea of a pitched battle is the wrong way to have the conversation. You've got to have a thoughtful one with people. Most of us who are in the countryside understand change. You just want to have an adult conversation about the costs and the benefits. And most importantly, you want to know it's about protecting somewhere like this.
But pitched battle is a really interesting phrase, because if we look at some of the debates that are going on at the moment, pitched battle seems to sum them up. And if you think about President Trump saying this year, he said, and I'm just looking at a quote I've got on my phone, this climate change, it's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion.
Fortunately, I'm a public servant, so I'm not allowed to get into politics. But I will say, one of the things about growing up in a place is that you know that change is happening, because your expectations of what the landscape is doing at a particular time are different from your memories.
Farmers are seeing more flooding,
right,
for example.
Yeah. So one of the things I struggle with as the parent to two small children is seeing how much less they already have here than I had. And in particular, it's the butterflies. That's the thing I noticed. The insects and the butterfly populations are still here, but there are far fewer of them than when I was a girl. And I find that devastating on one level. But then I see my children in the garden. There was a jaybird in the garden yesterday with acorns. They know the word for a jay. They know the word for newt. They know the words for kinds of trees and indeed wind turbines on the hill. They don't have that grief. I know the world is changing because I have lived experience here to know that it is. Anyone here will tell you that. And then when we do our social research at the Climate Change Committee, people do also know. It is incredibly patronising to suggest that people don't know that the weather, so much part of British life, isn't different, that our landscapes aren't changing, that we don't need to do something. I have never seen a poll that suggests otherwise. What they want to know is it fair? Is it fair? Is what the UK is doing fair compared to internationally? Is it fair across society? Who's paying for it and when? Once you explain to people that largely you're about removing fossil fuels and replacing it with clean electricity, that electricity should be cheaper, that the costs of doing decarbonisation are coming down, and that it will protect these places and things that we love, most people come with us.
When you left university, you went to work in finance, and then what was it that made you decide it wasn't for you?
Yes, barely. It didn't last my training contract in finance, because Frozen Planet came out, the David Attenborough documentary, and I'd gone into finance and I didn't dislike it, but my heart wasn't in it. And then the Frozen Planet documentary came out, and I remember sitting and watching the last episode, which was about the impact of climate change on the glaciers and on the ice sheets, and feeling honestly enraged, frightened, quite emotional about the change in that landscape and the description being given about what was happening there. And I went to work and quit my job and started looking for work in the environment on the Monday morning.
And when we look out over this view now and you think about your children growing up, paint for me, what's the worst case scenario if our generation doesn't do enough about climate change? And what's the best case scenario?
So the worst case scenario is we'll lose some of the things about this landscape that have been true for thousands of years through those waves of human settlement and civilization, because the temperate climate that it depends on will change. So if we're looking out, a lot of the woodland here is beech. Beech is particularly sensitive to changing temperatures and drought. So this is a native species which is at risk if the climate and the weather continues to change and we can't get it under control. So these places that seem so permanent and familiar are changing, and could be lost in the worst case if we allow climate change to go unchecked. I find what we've already lost hard to bear. But the hope is, in the time I've been working, in the 10 years that I've been working on climate change, many of the things that we need in order to fix the problem have become more available and cheaper. It's more expensive to destroy the world than to save it now. Electric vehicles, cheap energy technologies, heat pumps in houses, these technologies have come into their own only in the last decade, and you're seeing the emissions curve start to bend. And so I live on the knife edge of that hope and that fear. But there is no reason at all to think that we can't do something about it.
You've spelt out very clearly fears and hopes for the future. And this is something we ask all the guests who come on This Natural Life. Is there any one thing that you would pick out that gives you cause for hope?
I think it is in the fact that my children have a different relationship to this landscape than I do. So on a personal level, I see all the time the things that aren't here. The butterflies in the garden, the orchids on the common, the change in the landscape. My children just experience it as it is. And there was a jaybird in the garden yesterday morning eating acorns, and I find it just beautiful and glorious that they get to see that and they know what that is. Age 3 and 5, they still have a natural inheritance, they still have a connection with nature. It's different to my experience, just as mine was different to my granny's and my mum's, but it's still beautiful. And on a professional level, 60% of the emissions reduction to 2040 is in electricity, so in clean electricity. And the second that those technologies become cheaper than an alternative, people are going to buy them whatever they think about climate change. So my great hope, oddly, is that you don't have to care about climate change to want to do some of the things that we know that people will need to do.
Emma Pinchbeck, thank you so much for sharing your home landscape here in Rodborough Common for This Natural Life.
This Natural Life was presented by Martha Carney. The producer was Emma Campbell.
On BBC Sounds. Ensure all is calm this Christmas with a special festive sleeping forecast.
On Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house.
Wrap yourself in timeless tunes with my Christmas crooners mix. Classics from Bing Crosby to Michael Bublé.
Have a holly jolly Christmas.
And step back with soothing seasonal tracks on the Mindful Mix.
Get all kinds of Christmassy.
Just search Christmas music on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, it's time for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week on the programme, we talk about the cost of the summer drought.
Farmers are just finding it increasingly difficult to adapt and manage those impacts on their businesses, and it's really starting, I think, to take a toll.
Hear from the adjudicator trying to make supply chains fairer.
There is still a very real fear, I think, on the part of many farmers, and worries about coming forward and putting a formal complaint in.
Discover the joy that can be found in farming's winter jobs.
Hedge laying for me is the best thing that I do in the year, and I really look forward to winter.
And how you can protect rural traditions.
These are things people cherish, and we want to make sure that we recognise these for future generations as well.
More on Morris dancing, cheese rolling and dry stone walling later. Let's start, though, with what's happening on farms right now. You might think that winter offers a bit of a chance to wind down, but though there is less work in the fields, there are plenty of winter jobs to keep farmers busy. One of those chores is a sort of winter spring cleaning. Mary Ward-Lowry has been to meet Craig Williamson on his farm just north of Gainsborough to check for cobwebs, dust and old Land Rovers.
I don't think it's that easy to focus on tidying up when you've got 900 acres of arable land, chickens, alpacas, horses and a flock of sheep to look after. But keeping your sheds organised makes good business sense.
I've got a grand plan for this area here.
Oh yeah, what's your plan?
We're going to put some stables in the corn store,
oh,
some
yeah.
temporary stables for the winter, because it's not going to be corn in.
That's a job.
That's the thing, isn't it? Before you do any kind of project, you have to sort things out and tidy up. And it all
there is so much tidying up.
Yeah.
Because I've got years and years of stuff. Now, look, the potato harvester's still out.
So me and my son, Ben, we have this sort of argument. Please don't wash it. Please don't. I know it looks pretty, but please don't wash it. I'm paranoid that anything gets washed, you get bearings with water in, and then you've got to try and run it and put it away as it is, and then wash it next June. Bring it out in some sunshine. Then you can wash it just before you're going to use it. Because I know if I wash my tractor, there'll be some electrical fault suddenly happens because some water will get ingressed somewhere. It'll be beeping at me. And that is, it's the main problem. And then you're setting into 20 acres of Tates or 50 acres or whatever, and suddenly you get a bearing going. It's like, oh, why is that gone? Oh, yeah, because you got water in it.
And are you conscious, because I know you've diversified, haven't you? You've got a farm shop. And are you conscious of the image of the farm? Or do you think, oh, it doesn't matter if it doesn't look perfect because it's a working farm?
I think, and a lot of farmers will identify, I go past some farmyards and think, that is the tidiest yard in the world. I have a field just at the top where we have some sheep and alpacas and whatever, and I call it the Field of Dreams. And I've got all my project cars up there, outside, of course, and there's about four old Discoveries and an old Range Rover Classic and bits like that, which is like, ooh, one day,
all those Land Rover parts hidden in potato boxes will definitely come in handy. Craig's a tenant farmer, and he was only 29 when he took over the farm from his dad. A lot of tenant farmers feel a pressure to make the farm look unnaturally smart for the annual visit of the trustees. But Craig's attitude has changed over the years.
Having taken over at such a young age and then panic for so many years, look, you worry about tidying up when the landlord turns up. And no, we don't just get the landlord, we get all the trustees turn. About 30 of them come. They like coming here and they'll come into the shop. And I know Sally will keep this nice and tidy. And so they love to come and see what we're doing in the shop. They're not bothered about the farm side, it's the diversification side.
That's what they're
so they can go. So when they go back to London or wherever they go, and they go, oh yes, one of our tenants. I'm sure he doesn't say. He does actually sound like that. And then one of our tenants, yes, he's doing this and he's doing that, and they've got a park run and they've got a whatever that is, and they've got pumpkins and they've got alpacas, and what are we doing next? We're doing outdoor chickens, and as long as you pay the rent,
maybe
they do look and go, why has he got so many cars? Why do you need more than one car?
Craig Williamson there with a healthy attitude to tidying up. Winter is also the traditional time of year for hedge laying. The birds have long finished nesting, and by partly cutting through the trees and shrubs that you lay over to form the hedge, you also allow it to rejuvenate in time for the spring. Fiona Clampin caught up with hedge layer Stephen McCulloch at work on a hedge in Black Torrington in Devon.
So the first part of the process is cutting the tree just over halfway, maybe two-thirds, something like that. And it's a long diagonal cut. We call it a steeping cut down here in Devon, but other people call them pleaching. I've put the cut in with the chainsaw, and because this is a big stem, I'm now going to use the axe to open up the split. So the idea is that you want a long, shallow cut so the steeper doesn't split. I've just got to thin it out a little bit.
And that's a different tool you've got there. What's that?
So now I'm using the billhook. This is actually my grandfather's billhook. This is a Yorkshire pattern hook. There are lots of different pattern of hooks. I just like the Yorkshire pattern one because it's got the two blades on it, which is quite useful.
So you're cutting with the billhook and you're pushing the tree at the same time to encourage it to come down, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
It reminds me a bit of basket weaving, you know, working with willow, where you're bending the woods to do what you want.
Yeah, to be able to build a strong hedge, what you are looking to do is build it within itself, cutting pieces off, tucking them in, weaving it in and through, so you've then got a solid structure. All I'm doing is just working that split all the way down to the bottom and then just laying that piece into the hedge.
Why is it essential to do hedge laying work at this time of year?
First of all, you're outside of the bird nesting season, and also the sap isn't running quite so much at this time of year. And also, now the leaves are off, you can actually see what you're doing. You build a much better hedge when the leaves are off.
This is something that you do every year. and you're in a long line of people who've been doing this for centuries.
Hedge laying for me is the best thing that I do in the year, and I really look forward to winter. I'm drawn to it in two ways. The first is the actual skill part, the act of hedge laying, trying to build the best living fence that I can build. But often I'm drawn to thinking about who's steeped these hedges before, how they did it. I also wonder if they're happy with the work that I'm doing. And then I'm just going to knock this crook in to secure the hedge.
Perfect.
Love that.
Hedgeler Stephen McCulloch in Devon. Well, it seems a while since we were warm, but the repercussions of this year's heat and drought are still reverberating. They caused one of the worst harvests on record this summer and cost arable farmers in England more than £800 million. That's according to analysis from the think tank, the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, the ECIU. Tom Lancaster is land, food and farming analyst at the ECIU. He told me that while farmers are used to the vagaries of the weather, climate change means the challenges are growing.
What we're seeing increasingly is there's a lot more rough than there is smooth for particularly broadacre arable farmers who are, I think really we're only just coming to realise, particularly exposed to the increasingly extreme weather that we're seeing with climate change. You know, those farmers really have got nowhere to hide. A lot of these crops aren't irrigated and they're really dependent on the weather, effectively. And if it doesn't play ball, as it increasingly isn't, then they're really exposed to the impacts of that. And farmers are just finding it increasingly difficult to adapt and manage those impacts on their businesses. And it's really starting, I think, to take a toll, not just on their businesses, but in terms of their own sort of health and well-being as well.
So what are farmers to do? We've spoken to farmers who are considering more irrigation, but they're growing more valuable crops like vegetables or potatoes. It's not, generally speaking, worth irrigating a cereal crop. Do you think that will change, or will people change what they grow?
What we'll probably need to see change, really, is sort of government and the supply chain taking the resilience of our sort of farming sectors, not just arable, but livestock, horticulture and others, much more seriously in terms of how we can manage those impacts and the impacts that we're likely to see as the effects of climate change worsen. So from our perspective, the sort of green farming schemes that DEFRA are bringing forward in England are an important part of that. So those schemes can help farmers sort of build their resilience to these impacts. You've already seen that with some of the sort of farming advocates for regenerative agriculture or nature-friendly farming, climate-friendly farming, whatever you want to call it, seeing the evidence of those benefits in their soils and in increased numbers of pollinators, all of which can help build resilience to the sorts of extreme weather impacts that we've seen. You also, I think, will need to see the supply chain taking this a bit more seriously in terms of investing in their suppliers to be able to guarantee a sufficient supply of sort of homegrown produce into UK shops and supermarket aisles. And again, I think you're starting to see supermarkets realise the importance of domestic supply and ensuring the sort of resilience of that in the face of climate impacts, with some of the big retailers investing significant investments into their supplier base in recent months.
Tom Lancaster from the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. This week, the first cases of blue tongue disease in Northern Ireland were confirmed. Tests found that two cows on a farm in County Down have the disease, with a further 44 in the same herd suspected of having it. Blue tongue is spread by midges and affects sheep, cattle and other ruminants, but not humans. It's been prevalent in Europe and, as we've reported, there have so far been more than 200 cases in England and Wales since July this year, though none in Scotland. A 20-kilometre control zone has been implemented around Bangor in County Down, and the livestock market has been temporarily closed. BBC Northern Ireland's environment correspondent Louise Cullen reports.
John Martin's 180-acre farm sits on the shores of Strangford Loch and squarely in the blue tongue virus 20-kilometre control zone.
So we're predominantly sheep, due to lamb, but nearly 700 sheep this year, split between January and March, and we also have some cattle. We still have about 150 sheep due to sell over the next month or so in this marketing year. So we now have some additional licensing that's required because we're in the control zone, but we can move direct to the factory for processing. People who are selling through the live market, it's more of a restriction because there are no live markets happening within the zone currently, and they have to find another route to sell their stock.
You've been feeling the effects of blue tongue, though. Tell me about that.
So we're a closed flock, so we breed all our female, own female replacements, but we do rely on purchasing superior genetics on the ram side. Because of the movement restrictions, moving from GB as a restricted blue tongue area, we haven't been able to access maybe the genetics that we wanted, particularly on the maternal side, to breed our own female replacement. So we've had to source rams locally here in Northern Ireland for the last couple of years, but it does put a bit of a limitation on the genetic improvement that we're trying to bring into the flock.
How to protect those flocks and herds is now on everyone's minds.
There's been a mixed view within the veterinary profession, and farmers rely on their vets to provide advice. Some vets were suggesting that all stock should be vaccinated. Some were suggesting that the climate here wasn't sufficiently warm for a long enough period of time for the particular image to become a problem. So there's a range of views, but I think going forward now that we've had an outbreak, that's something that lots of people, myself included, will be actively considering.
With the disease present in Northern Ireland, moving live, susceptible animals across the border into the Republic of Ireland will only be permitted where they can meet standardised animal health certification requirements. Moves direct for slaughter will continue to be permitted. The hope is colder weather could prove the best weapon.
Obviously at the moment, as I said, is the low point in midge activity. But the concern would be if it is confirmed and identified that blue tongue is active and potentially circulating, that once midges become active again through the spring and into the summer, then it becomes much more of an issue. And I think that's when people will make a serious judgment about using the vaccine to try and protect their stock.
That report from Louise Cullen. There's also been concerning news this week from Spain, where two wild boar were found to have died from African swine fever, ASF. These are the first cases there since 1994. 13 other countries in the EU have had cases of ASF, leading to the loss of more than 2 million commercial pigs. Well, now the UK has temporarily banned the import of all pig products from Spain, while the government there tries to contain the disease. African swine fever is a virus spread by ticks, but it can also infect pigs if they eat infected meat. It's usually fatal for animals and there's no effective vaccine. ASF doesn't affect people. For Spain, though, the presence of the disease will have a huge impact, as it is the EU's biggest pork producer and exporter. Lizzie Wilson, Chief Executive of the National Pig Association here in the UK, spoke to Anna Hill.
African swine fever in Spain means that it has crept even closer to the UK. Also, it is a huge geographical leap, so that the closest other ASF outbreak is Italy, a very significant distance. And generally, when it's such a huge leap, it's human mediated. So there's some sort of human transition element been at play there. Spain is also the EU's biggest pork producer and exporter. And therefore, because it will have temporarily lost its entire export market, there is going to be a lot of cheaper Spanish pig meat on the market looking for another home. And that will have serious consequences for our domestic pig price and our market as well.
These cases are in wild boar. Does that make it less of a worry?
No, it's more of a worry, to be honest, because Spain has quite a large wild boar population, which means we've no idea how far it spread. It will be far more difficult to control and eradicate, and proving that freedom from disease is going to be extremely challenging. We have heard, there is anecdotal evidence that wild boar numbers specifically within that Catalonia area are quite out of control. There's lots of them located around towns and kind of around domestic bins. So again, you know, really high risk, to be honest, with regards to spreading that notifiable disease.
When you say around public bins, are you suspecting that these animals might have eaten some food which had been thrown away and contracted it like that?
Potentially, and it would definitely explain the huge geographical leap from the last known ASF case, which was Italy.
But that means, doesn't it, that there are pork products which are being eaten, which might have the virus in them?
Potentially, and that's exactly why we've been lobbying so hard for so long now with regards to our own national border control and biosecurity. Because that, I mean, that's the risk, is contaminated, illegally imported pig meat finding its way into our pig population in the UK.
Just to point out, this disease does not affect humans, does it?
No, not at all. No, no, pigs only.
The UK imports around 37,000 tonnes a year of pork and pig products from Spain. What are the controls then around when that meat gets to the border? And if you're worried, as you said, about infected meat coming in, what is happening now? Is it being held and stored?
Yeah, so currently our government have placed a complete ban on all pork products from Spain, and all of those products will be held at border control posts until further notice. Our government then needs to speak to Spain basically and negotiate some sort of regionalisation agreement. So that means that they will be able to export pork products from other non-affected regions across the country. And that's something that we've now got to discuss and agree with Spain for the UK.
Lizzie Wilson from the National Pig Association. With milk processors continuing to cut the prices they pay farmers for their milk, the man appointed to ensure fairness and transparency in the UK agricultural supply chain says he'll be watching out for any breaches in the coming months. Richard Thompson is the first in the new adjudicator role, which started a year ago, looking first at the dairy supply chain. His report, which covers the year from July 2024 to June this year, says some farmers are still afraid to speak out in case of reprisals.
For some farmers, that's meant even having a written contract in the first place. So some farmers I've spoken to over the last year have said either it's the first time they've had a written contract or the first time it's been updated since the 1980s in one instance, one farmer I was talking to. But contracts now must have much greater transparency and set out the terms of business between a milk purchaser and a farmer, including important features like describing if a milk price changes, if there's a variable price under a contract, setting out the factors on which that price change takes place. So a farmer should have a much better ability both to predict how milk prices may change in the future, but also to check and to challenge if they don't think that that price has changed fairly and in accordance with what the contract says.
As you mentioned in the report, milk prices are under pressure at the moment. We've seen cuts of 3.5p a litre, 3p a litre. How can you ensure that there's still going to be fairness in this supply chain?
So the regulations help ensure that farmers receive a fair price for their milk. And as I say, ensure much greater transparency about how that price is calculated. But ultimately, of course, prices will continue to be determined by the market itself, the new regulations. And my role isn't to seek to set or control the milk price itself. But farmers should have much more confidence that they're only bearing a fair share of the risks and the costs if milk prices do fall. And they should have a much better understanding of the factors that impact the milk price and be better able to plan ahead as a result. I mean, a fair price is ultimately what the market can sustain and deliver. And many farmers I've spoken to in recent months recognise that in terms of oversupply, the market price is going to be depressed.
You do mention in the report that there is some nervousness in people coming forward. Are people getting in touch with you?
So they are, yes. During the first year of operation, we didn't receive any formal complaints, but we've had 15 farmers come forward with particular issues they wanted to talk to us about in confidence. And in most of those cases, we've been able to use that information to speak to either individual processors or their represented bodies to seek to influence and to change things for the better. But as our report established, there is still a very real fear, I think, on the part of many farmers and worries about coming forward and putting a formal complaint in. And that's why we introduced our new in-confidence channel earlier this year so that farmers could come and talk to us completely in confidence.
Richard Thompson. Now, could there be a more traditional sound? For some, that's fabulous. For others, not so much. But rural traditions, from Morris dancing to Eisteddfods, and crafts like drystone walling or tartan weaving, could be internationally protected. This week, the government launched its search for UK living heritage to create an inventory of traditions. It's the first time the UK has taken part in this. UNESCO began an international list in 2008, which includes Iranian carpet weaving, baguette making in France, and a coaxing tradition for camels from Mongolia. Baroness Fiona Twycross, Heritage Minister in the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, wants your nominations.
We're really keen for people to be part of a national conversation about the crafts, customs and celebrations that are valued by communities up and down the country in order to help us safeguard them for future generations.
So how does this work then with getting them onto this UNESCO list? Do you choose? Do we choose?
So I think it would be definitely not up for me to choose. So this is about what communities themselves value and want to shout about and want to have recognition. So the inventories are going to be shaped by communities around the country, with living heritage traditions being submitted on behalf of the people who practice them themselves. So submissions are open for the next 4 months, with the hope that we can draw up our first UK inventory later next year. So we're really keen for everyone who practices a heritage tradition to work with their community and submit their practice to our Living Heritage Inventory.
So you have to be doing it rather than just watching it. You have to be a Morris dancer or a cheese roller or a teller of Scottish folk stories.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's so many different groups, and I think you've given some really good examples of the type of traditions we've got. It's an enormous stock-taking exercise, in effect, to try and identify all the living heritage traditions across the country.
And do they all then make it onto a UNESCO list, or do you have to winnow them down a bit?
Well, there's an independent review panel that will check whether each submission meets the criteria for joining the inventory, but they're not going to be making a value judgment or limiting the numbers of things that can go on, or making an assessment of the significance or importance of the submissions. So this is very much a community-based bottom-up approach to heritage, which will create the inventory. There isn't a limit on how many submissions can be made.
In the nicest way, what's the point?
I think this is about making sure that we recognise the real wealth of tradition across the country and the heritage that is not just part of a museum exhibition or it's what people practice and it's what people value. These are things people cherish, and we want to make sure that we recognise these for future generations as well. So these may be things, as in my case, my mum's taught me how to make jam. She's taught me how to make marmalade, shortbread and scones. I want future generations to get insight into that kind of culinary practice, but also the craft, social practices and performing arts that make us the country that we are.
Heritage Minister Baroness Twycross. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Rebecca Rooney, and Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
You're listening to Radio 4, where now Sarah Keith-Lucas has all the weather. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning. Things are looking very unsettled through the weekend. We've got low pressure in the driving seat, bringing us heavy, blustery downpours today, strong winds in the south as well, and there'll be more rain around for many places tomorrow as well. But let's start with the detail across the southern half of the UK. So all of southern England, Wales, through the Midlands, into eastern England as well. We've got lots of heavy showers. They'll be coming and going as the brisk westerly or southwesterly winds are going to blow those showers through. So expect very changeable conditions right across the region. Could be some thunderstorms in the mix as well. And the winds are as strong as 50 miles an hour, perhaps even 60 miles an hour around some very exposed coastal areas. That's bringing big waves, and we've had very high spring tides at the moment. So there's the risk of coastal flooding, particularly for parts of South Wales, along the south coast of England and through the Bristol Channel as well. Mild though, temperatures around 11 to 13 degrees. Further north, so northern England, all of Scotland and Northern Ireland, plenty of showers around, very cloudy start to the day. It's windy at the moment across the northeast of Scotland. The winds will slowly ease. It will stay windy though across the Northern Isles. Gusts here 50 miles an hour with frequent showers. But for the rest of the region, actually a slightly improving picture as both the winds and the showers tend to ease away into the afternoon. Some brighter spells and temperatures around 8 to 11 degrees.
Now through tonight then, most of the downpours clear away, the winds will start to ease, could be some fog forming, especially in the north, but then more rain moves in close to the south coast by dawn. Overnight lows somewhere between about 3 to 8, so it is staying mild and frost-free. But for tomorrow then, a dry start for many of us, but rain in the south will move northwards and eastwards through the course of the day. It'll be turning windy again, especially in the south where gales are possible, but it is staying mild with temperatures around 8 to 14 degrees. I do expect the potential though for some pretty disruptive and stormy weather Monday night and into Tuesday.
Many thanks, Sarah. The Today programme with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson is next. And looking further ahead to this evening, we're celebrating a special anniversary for a true touchstone of the Radio 4 schedule.
From our own correspondent at 70.
All that evening, Baghdad had been shaking.
I remember recognising Chairman Mao's brilliant...
In charge of this Aladdin's cave is a babushka.
I'm Anna Foster, and to celebrate seven decades of global reporting, I'll be talking to some familiar foreign correspondents.
And the soldier says, no, 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 no press. And Jeremy says, BBC. And the soldier looks at him and goes, Lise Doucette?
Including Lise Doucette, Jeremy Bowen, Steve Rosenberg, and Kate Adey.
Wow, what a fook I could write.
From our own correspondent at 70 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Tonight at 8.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 6th of December. Good morning, this is Today with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb.
Good morning, the headlines today. England and Scotland are absorbing the news of tough draws for next year's World Cup and waiting to find out the cities where they will play. We take a look back at last night's spectacle and at Donald Trump being awarded that other Peace Prize.
We congratulate the 2025 FIFA Peace Prize, Football Unites the World recipient, President Donald J. Trump.
Our other main headline, the blockbuster deal between Netflix and Warners has been criticised by some members of Congress amid calls for regulators to block it. We find out what the potential merger with Warner Brothers means for us here.
You'll already start to see changes in prices, changes in content, changes in licensing, changing in availability of content. There'll be a big change.
Also coming up, the Royal College of GPs on whether doctors are overdiagnosing mental health disorders, and there's a move for UK traditions and crafts to be officially recognised.
Every wall I've built is literally a piece of heritage that will last for centuries, and it's been there for centuries as well.
We'll hear that, how that could protect the economic benefits.
Good morning, I'm Jonathan Ledyard with your Saturday Sport. Ben Stokes and his England cricket team continue to feel heat from the Australian sun and batsmen, but can Lando Norris and his McLaren team rise to the challenge of becoming Formula One world champion in Abu Dhabi?
The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
England and Scotland will find out more today about their draw for the Men's World Cup next year and where they'll play their matches. The tournament will be the biggest in the competition's history, with 48 nations taking part. In a glitzy event in Washington DC last night, England were drawn in a group with Croatia, Ghana and Panama. Scotland, making their first World Cup appearance since 1998, will face Brazil, Morocco and Haiti. From Washington, here's our sports editor, Dan Roan.
As well as being handed challenging draws, both England and Scotland know they'll be playing games in the east of North America. Which host cities and at precisely what times will be revealed by FIFA at a scheduling announcement later today, but the choices could be crucial. Teams playing in that part of the United States during last summer's Club World Cup faced extreme heat and storm delays, and that, along with the wishes of broadcasters, will determine kickoff times. If they win their group, England could face the daunting prospect of Mexico in Mexico City in the round of 16, and then a mouth-watering match against five-time winners Brazil in the quarter-final of an expanded tournament featuring 104 matches across 16 cities.
Officials from Washington and Kiev say real progress towards ending the war in Ukraine depends on Moscow showing serious commitment to long-term peace. A second day of talks in Florida has ended with the US and Ukraine agreeing to a framework for post-war security and reviewing recovery projects. They'll meet again later today. Our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports.
Talks about the latest US proposals on the Ukraine war have now stretched across 2 weeks and multiple venues. After a meeting in Florida, Mr. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, posted an update to X in which he said Ukraine had reaffirmed its position that any settlement must respect its independence and sovereignty. The State Department said talks between Mr. Witkoff, Mr. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Ukraine's Rustem Umerov had agreed the framework of security arrangements. But the party said real progress would depend on Russia's readiness to show commitment to long-term peace. A Kremlin aide has said negotiations between Russia and the US are making progress and mentioned the possibilities of another face-to-face meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin. Talks between Ukrainian and US negotiators will reconvene today in Miami.
The Royal College of GPs says family doctors are having to strike a difficult balance when patients expect a diagnosis for mental health conditions but don't meet the criteria. Hundreds of GPs have told the BBC they think such conditions are being overdiagnosed. This week, the government launched an independent review into mental health, autism and ADHD services. Our health correspondent Catherine Burns has more details.
752 GPs took part in our research. 442 of them said that on balance, they believed mental health problems were being overdiagnosed. 81 had the opposite view, that underdiagnosis was the issue. The Royal College of GPs said it was important not to medicalise the full range of normal feelings and behaviours experienced by people, and to ensure GPs were not being pressured into making diagnoses that conflict with their clinical judgement. 508 doctors also told us they were worried about a lack of mental health provision in their area for adults. For children, 640 GPs said there was rarely or never enough good quality help available. An independent review is expected to report back next summer.
Members of Congress have expressed concern about the proposed takeover by Netflix of Warner Brothers' streaming and studio business. The $72 billion deal ends weeks of negotiations, but it still needs approval and there may be obstacles in its way. Our North America business correspondent Samira Hossain reports from New York.
It took just hours for lawmakers in Washington to raise the alarm about the potential merger, saying it could force Americans to pay more for streaming services and give them less choice about how they watch. The other hurdle could come from the White House. Paramount Skydance, another company also bidding for Warner Brothers, has called the deal unfair. Paramount boss David Ellison is the son of Larry Ellison, a big Republican donor and a Trump supporter who has invested heavily in a number of the president's key economic projects.
Trans women will not be allowed to take part in the main session at next year's Labour Women's Conference. The event was cancelled this year in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling on gender, but will return in 2026. It's understood formal proceedings, which include speeches in the main hall and debates on policy, will be restricted to biological women only. A BBC investigation has found that driving instructors across England are being offered up to £250 a month to hand over their official test booking login details to touts. The touts are then bulk booking driving tests and selling the slots to learners on social media. NJ Convery reports.
There are currently well over 500,000 learner drivers in Great Britain waiting to take their test. 21-week delays have led many to turn to third-party resellers, paying hundreds for a booking which should cost no more than £75. We have identified touts operating in London, Birmingham, Manchester and the home counties. Posing as driving instructors, we approached them and were offered monthly payments in exchange for access to the DVSA's driving instructor test booking system. The resale of test slots has been reported before, but this is the first time that driving instructors have been implicated in these schemes. We put our findings to the DVSA. They told us they do not comment on individual complaints, but added that any instructors who are involved may be investigated. New rules are expected in the spring, meaning only learners can book tests.
Documents have revealed that a lifestyle app backed by the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, received more than £1 million of taxpayer funding before it folded without ever launching a product. Vavoosh was launched in 2010 by her friend Manuel Fernandez, and Sarah Ferguson described herself as an ambassador for the company. Neither of them responded to requests for comment. Ben King reports.
Vavoosh promise to give users the power to find, plan, share, live and remember all the things they love to do. In 15 years, it raised £9 million, more than £1 million of which was research and development tax credits from the government. It was put into administration last month when its Indian software developer threatened legal action. Administrators say Mr. Fernandez ceased communicating with the other directors after he resigned earlier this year and is believed to have left the country.
One of the world's best-known architects, Frank Gehry, has died, aged 96. He won international acclaim for his bold designs, including the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles and the glass sails on the Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris. Perhaps his most famous building was the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, with its broad sweeps of titanium and stone. He once said he'd been surprised by the success of his work.
They asked for the Sydney Opera House. They said, we want a building that does for Bilbao what the Sydney Opera House does for Australia. And I looked at them and I said, okay. I didn't ever expect we'd achieve what we did.
Cricket and Australia are extending their lead in the second Ashes test in Brisbane. In reply to the tourists' first innings total of 334, Australia have now reached 478 for 8, a lead of 144. Australia lead the five test series 1-0.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It is now 9 minutes past seven. Let's start this morning's programme with a quick look across the morning front pages. And there's no really consistent pattern other than the tabloids can't get enough of the football. So if you're reading The Sun or The Mirror down south, of course, not north of the border, you get a focus on who England got in that draw. That's gotta be tough. The Sun says The Mirror won a hell of a draw. You'll know what that means if you follow football. The Daily Star has fun at Donald Trump's expense. Taking the piece, it says, referring to that prize. In more serious news, the iWeekend says wear face mask if you feel ill, public told. This is advice from the UK Health Security Agency that given the spread of a rather virulent form of flu, that if people have got any form of symptoms, they should consider wearing a face mask. And some interesting politics on the front page of the Telegraph under the headline, Streeting Rayner and the Pact for Number 10. The paper reports that the Health Secretary's allies, Wes Streeting's allies, are pressing Angela Rayner to sign up to a joint ticket for the Labour leadership. Mr. Streeting, you won't be surprised to say, officially denies this as a silly season story and insists there's no vacancy, dearie me, no.
One story that almost certainly is going to lead to further debate in the weeks ahead is an extraordinary interview that The Times has done with Baroness Faulkner, whose term as head of the Equality and Human Rights Commission ended last week, and she has really gone into this interview all guns blazing. She has told The Times that Labour have lost touch with their fundamental values. What's really depressing, she says, about the current state of the Labour Party is that they seem to have completely abandoned, these are her words, completely abandoned women's rights. The traditional party of rights in my 40 years in the country, she says, was the Labour Party, the party of feminism. But she says that is not the case anymore. And she says it about two issues. One is trans rights. The other is the grooming gang. So because of those things, she says, the Labour Party can no longer call itself the party of equality and feminism. And the Times, towards the end of their interview or their news story about the interview, does has gone to a Labour source who says that the party is delivering a comprehensive strategy to support women and tackle violence.
Another striking message delivered to governments all round Europe is on the front page of the FT. US security strategy urges resistance to Europe and shrugs off the Russia threat. This is the new national security strategy that was published yesterday, which the Financial Times, says underscores the radical reorientation of American foreign policy under Donald Trump because it attacks EU governments for undermining political liberty and sovereignty and appears at least to encourage voters to support populist parties who want to topple them.
Just a final thought, Nick, you were talking about the tabloids and the football. You didn't mention the Daily Star. We don't often get the Daily Star. It's kind of intermittent thing.
Taking the piece,
which was fantastic. But I mean, it's interesting that they were not convinced by the award given to Donald Trump.
none of them were.
Yeah, you can always write a line in the stars to give us a smile. It is now 12 minutes past seven. The Royal College of GPs has entered the debate about whether mental health problems are being overdiagnosed in this country, with a warning that we must not medicalise the full range of normal feelings and behaviours. It comes after a BBC survey of GPs showed hundreds of doctors expressing concern, which perhaps can be summed up by one GP with the words, "Life being stressful is not an illness." Well, let's talk to the Royal College's Medical Director for Clinical Policy, Adrian Hayter. Morning to you.
Morning, Nick.
What's the concern you and your members have got?
I think, actually, what we have, you know, the concern that we've got is that the system at the moment is quite stretched. And as you were quite rightly saying, at the moment, there's kind of a lot of respiratory illness and flu. And so patients with conditions which are sometimes difficult to diagnose. A diagnosis takes a bit of time for a diagnosis of a mental health disorder, are not always going to get that full assessment right at that particular time. And so I think kind of what the message is really that GPs are still around. We're still here to support our patients. And sometimes conditions relating to mental health conditions, such as depression, take a little bit of time to work through and get a proper diagnosis. Now, there are also people who are living with in difficult times. And those people equally have the right to be able to get the right support. And sometimes that first port of call is the GP. And there are things that the general practice can do to be able to support those patients. There are wider, there's wider support within primary care and general practice as well. So I think part of it is to bear with us as GPs.
You're being very diplomatic, if I could say, Dr. Hayter. And the West Streeting, the health secretary, was rather less diplomatic, wasn't he, last weekend, when he said, look, mental health is overdiagnosed in this country. Lots of GPs in our survey say the same thing, that people who have normal lives in which you have down days as well as up days insist they're mentally ill and demand from the GP some form of treatment or prescription.
Yeah, and absolutely. I've been the GP for 30 years, Nick, and I've come across lots of different situations. And we are there usually to walk alongside patients in their hectic and busy lives, but also sometimes at those really low points. Now, a diagnosis like depression is a mental health diagnosis. And as GPs, we follow the science and use the right pathways of care to make that diagnosis.
But is there a danger that you feel pressurized as doctors to medicalize something, simply, frankly, to get someone out of your consulting room and have space for the people who've got more serious conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. And as that's what I was saying in terms of that pressure. But also, I think kind of what you know, we have to do is, as a profession, hold on to the values and the professionalism that we have as GPs. And for me, that is following that pathway of care and creating the right diagnosis. Can I give you an example of a patient? You know, in terms of that, recently I've had a patient who is a young person and probably has a number of different conditions as well as having a low mood. And so it's taken me the last 3 or 4 weeks to be able to come to a thought around the diagnosis and probably actually one or two different diagnoses.
Yeah.
So that is not a quick process.
Understood.
It's a complex process, but it takes time. And that patient deserves that kind of time to be able to deliver the right diagnosis.
And we are out of time, I'm afraid. But thank you for joining us. Adrian Hayter there from the Royal College of GPs.
16 minutes past seven. A lifestyle app backed by the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, received more than £1 million, it seems, of taxpayers' money before folding. Simon Jones is our correspondent, who's here in the studio. What was the app, Simon? What happened?
Well, you probably won't have heard of Vavoosh, which was an app that promised to give users the power to find, plan, share, live and remember all the things you love to do and all the things you've yet to try. But no one got to try this app because it never actually got to market. It was founded in 2010 by a close friend of Sarah Ferguson, Manuel Fernandez. Miss Ferguson once described herself as an ambassador for the company. She was an investor in it. And Mr. Fernandez and Miss Ferguson were regularly photographed together in 2015 and 2016. They attended Sir Bob Geldof's wedding together. But Vavoosh, over the course of 15 years, raised about £9 million. And £1 million of that was research and development tax credits from the UK government, and it paid teams in the UK and India to work on the app, but it never launched. So essentially, it didn't have a future, and it was put into administration last month when its Indian software developer threatened legal action. And administrators say Mr. Fernandez ceased communicating with the other directors after he resigned earlier this year, and there's significant uncertainty about how much money creditors would get back. And Vavoosh owes £50,000 to Miss Ferguson's company, La Luna Investments. But the failure of Vavoosh raises further questions about her judgment and her business relationships she pursued, although she and Mr. Fernandez haven't commented when asked to comment.
Right,
on
okay. Well, that's the obvious thing. She's at the moment, she's not saying anything about it because it's a pretty difficult time for her. And I assume this has been put to her, but at the moment, she's not commenting.
She hasn't commented. No comment either from HMRC about the tax credits the company received. But you're right saying it's a difficult time. In September, she was dropped by several charities. That's after an email she'd written in 2011 emerged when she called the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein her supreme friend. And of course, now we can't call her Duchess anymore. She's lost that title. At the same time, her former husband, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, relinquished his use of the Duke of York. And along with Andrew, she's having to move out of Royal Lodge and make her own living arrangement. So a lot of questions she's facing, but we haven't heard from her.
Simon Jones, thank you.
It is now 19 minutes past seven. At what age should people be able to ask for an assisted death? That was the central question yesterday in Parliament, as peers once again debated a bill that would allow some terminally ill adults in England and Wales the right to request help to end their lives. Here's Alicia McCarthy.
Peers have put forward more than 1,000 possible changes to the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, but so far only a handful have been discussed. At the start of the day, the government's business manager, Lord Kennedy, made a heartfelt appeal to peers.
I would hope that noble laws can make much greater progress today to ensure that a wider range of important amendments can be scrutinised in the time available.
Moving her amendments, the Labour peer Lady Berger argued 18, the bill's current age limit, was too young, and there were already circumstances in which local authorities and others had responsibility for youngsters up to the age of 25. She said peers had heard from experts who thought the higher age would be safer.
In general, the brain does not finish developing until a person is in their mid-20s. And this is particularly the case of the prefrontal cortex, which governs our decision-making functions and our ability to think flexibly about potential outcomes.
But another Labour peer, Lady Hayter, argued people in their 20s could have families and careers.
And to then say, but I'm sorry, you're 24 years of age and you cannot be helped in your last few days or months, weeks possibly, because you're only 24, I find extraordinary.
A crossbench peer and expert in palliative care, Lady Finlay, put forward a compromise.
One solution may be to require an enhanced assessment of those between 18 and 25. If the age limit is not actually going to be raised, but that at these young people should have a more in-depth assessment.
Under the bill as it stands, a request for an assisted death would have to be signed off by two doctors and approved by a panel made up of a senior legal figure, a psychiatrist and a social worker. The peer who's steering the legislation through the Lords, Labour's Lord Faulkner, said 18 was the age at which patients were allowed to make decisions on their medical care, and he still thought it was the right age. But he offered to go away and talk to Lady Finlay and others.
And I'm not saying I'm going to change the age of 18, but I'm saying, do we need a more thorough assessment for people between 18 and 25? That is broadly my position.
For the government, Lady Merran said a higher age limit could face legal challenge, for example, on the grounds of discrimination.
There would need to be a reasonable justification for restricting access to assisted dying to people aged either 21 and over or 25 and over. And noble lords will want to consider this in relation to these amendments.
At the end of the debate, Lady Berger withdrew her amendment for now. Any votes will come at a later stage of the process. Peers will continue their debate on the bill next Friday.
Alicia McArthur reporting there on yesterday in Parliament. It is now 22 minutes past seven. Never has the Eurovision slogan, United by Music, seemed less fitting. Donna International was for many the symbol of Eurovision as it was, a festival of camp and glitz
and Europop. And she's been reflecting on what the decision of Ireland, Spain, Slovenia and the Netherlands to quit this contest in protest at Israel's participation tells us and tells Israelis. In a social media post in English, she wrote, "You don't punish an entire country because you disagree politically with its government." But interesting, in another post in Hebrew, she asked the question, "How did we become one of the most hated countries in the world?" In a second, we'll reflect on that with someone who's been actively involved with the Israeli Eurovision delegation. First, though, let's hear from one of those countries boycotting this contest, the Spanish.
I hope that there are many other countries that follow our example. It looks like once daily pictures of the indiscriminate massacre of tens of thousands of people, children, are out of the headlines and news bulletins. It looks like we should look somewhere else and normalize the situation. That's not possible.
That was a Spanish government minister called Pablo Bustindoy. Let's turn, as I say now, to hear the view from Israel itself, with a man who has been involved with the Israeli Eurovision delegation for a very long time, head of press for them, also been a judge, written novels set against the backdrop of Eurovision. He is Alon Amir. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. I also worked with Dara International when we won in Birmingham.
And that was such a long time ago now, 1998, wasn't it? And
Were you calling me old?
To read her different posts, you sort of sense the anguish that this is causing in Israel. On the one hand, anger, how dare you? And on the other, how on earth did we get here as a nation? Is that how it feels to you?
Yeah, but I have the answer. I mean, it's the Israeli government. You need to remember, the vast majority of us Israeli were against Netanyahu and against the Israeli government. It's fine to criticize the Israeli government. We do that all the time. We're not happy with this situation and with this right-winged government that we don't support. I can understand why people don't like Israel and Israelis, unfortunately. However, we're not all like that. The vast majority of us are against the Israeli government.
But the boycotting nations, I think their argument is that Israel's participation in Eurovision is used politically. And they claim that the vote, the public vote that there is, which is a crucial part of the contest, is effectively, if not rigged, is organised to drive Israel up the voting list in order to make a statement about the country's position in the world.
Okay, if we have the time, I will explain. First of all, the contest is a competition between the broadcasters, not the country, and that's a major thing. So the broadcaster, the Israeli broadcaster, is an independent one and criticises the government. So that's a thing. What was the other thing you were talking about?
Well, it was about the voting system, wasn't it? There was a row about the voting system.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we finished in the bottom when it comes to the juries, and very well, first or second, when it comes to the televotes. Now, nobody said the same thing when Norway finished 18th with the juries in 2019, but first in the juries. Nobody said Norway had rigged the contest. This is the hypocrisy we're talking about. Now, I can explain why Israel doesn't do well with the juries in the past couple of years, but does very well with the televotes, like Ukraine when they won. It was a way for people to show their support in Ukraine. And you're a bit surprised that there are a lot of people in Europe that support Israel's right to protect itself.
Mr. Amir, we've only got time for one more sentence, but I do want to give you the chance to do it. How do you walk the tightrope? And as an Israeli who dislikes Netanyahu, dislikes the government, is uncomfortable with the war, but still wants to be out there in the world proudly waving your flag.
Well, we're out there in the world doing our thing. We will be part in Eurovision, and if someone doesn't like it, it's okay for them to withdraw. It's been done before by many other countries. Many other countries have sent songs that show or reflected the situation in their countries in Eurovision entries. We're not the first one doing that, but we're the one that are being called out about it and that we're wrong doing that, even though a lot of countries have done that before. That's the European hypocrisy when it comes to Israel.
Alon Amir, former head of press for the Israeli Eurovision delegation. Thanks for joining us.
27 minutes past 7. Sport time. Here's Jonathan.
First Stop Brisbane, good morning, where Australia keep piling on the pain for Ben Stokes and his England cricket team. The home side resumed on the third day of the second test on 374 for six. And would you believe it, their star bowler Mitchell Starc is now leading the charge. Let's go live to the Gabba for an update from Henry Moran.
Where the lead is now 157, the score 491 for 8. It has been a day of almost unremitting bleakness for England, who have struggled for ideas, struggled for opportunities. And though they did take two wickets earlier on, since the interval we have just seen this continuation of the runs piling on. Mitchell Starc's on 77 off 139 balls, and this now, in terms of time and overs, is the second longest partnership in the series. It is frustration beyond frustration for England and their supporters. Australia 4-9-1 for 8, the lead 157.
Keep going, Henry. We'll talk to you in an hour. Commentary continuing on TMS and BBC Sounds. So, how was the World Cup draw for you? Long enough? Fun enough? England and Scotland eventually discovered their opponents in the group stages for next year's tournament, to be played across three countries for the first time and featuring a record 48 teams. Because, as our football correspondent John Murray reports from Washington, the draw ceremony was also unlike anything we've ever seen before.
Live from the heart of Washington, D.C., the FIFA World Cup 2026 final draw.
There was a certain irony that for a World Cup next summer, when sweltering temperatures will be a recurring theme, the draw unfolded inside the Kennedy Centre with snow in the air and thick on the ground outside. On the stage, the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, proved himself to be not one for understatement.
We are here, of course, to celebrate the FIFA World Cup 2026 draw. What will be the greatest FIFA World Cup ever. It's much more than just a sporting event. It's simply the greatest event that humanity, that mankind has ever seen and will ever see.
Some setting of the bar that. For sure, it will be the biggest World Cup yet. And FIFA laid on the longest draw ceremony for it, a marathon lasting over 2 hours. And it was 87 minutes before they reached the main body of the draw. Before that came the awarding by FIFA, who declares in its own statutes it is neutral in matters of politics, of their new Peace Prize, with the winner, to the surprise of absolutely no one,
for his exceptional actions taken in the cause of world peace that have helped unite people across our world, we congratulate the 2025 FIFA Peace Prize Football Unites the World recipient, President Donald J. Trump.
This is truly one of the great honors of my life. And beyond awards, John and I were discussing this. We saved millions and millions of lives. The world is a safer place now. The United States 1 year ago was not doing too well. And now I have to say we're the hottest country anywhere in the world, and we're going to keep it that way. Thank you all. Thank you. Have a great time. And Johnny, a tremendous honor. Thank you.
And from the other co-hosts, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney and Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum duly joined President Trump on stage to get the balls rolling. And the former England player Rio Ferdinand had the responsibility as conductor to steer us through a draw that had its complications.
I forgot my pen, yep, though. We got
a pen. New pen. I got one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. I know.
Yeah.
I'm ready. The rehearsals weren't like this.
And it's fair to say it hasn't received widespread critical acclaim. Sitting close to the stage in the Kennedy Centre Concert Hall was the England head coach, Thomas Tuchel.
I do not like it, but we could have done it without all of this. I don't need it, but it's a huge stage, and it's big entertainment. I was very well aware that it's not about the deep insight of football today. It was about the presentation. It was about the entertainment, and this was the first step.
And no one seemed more entertained than the President of the United States himself, who danced along as the ceremony played out to one of his favourites.
Well, in the real world, England open against Croatia on June the 17th, and it's Ghana and Panama. For Scotland, it's Haiti first on June the 13th, before facing Morocco and Brazil. Good news! We're cheering up Henry Moran and all England cricket supporters. Good morning again, Henry. Tell us more.
Because Mitchell Starc is out, he is being caught off the bowling of Brydon Carse for 77. The catch taken by Ben Stokes, though he did nearly crash into teammate Ben Duckett as he took the catch. But Australia 4-9, 1-9, the lead 157.
Thank you very much, Henry. More from Henry in an hour. And just to say, in the next hour, we'll also be talking to the 1996 world champion Damon Hill as Britain's Lando Norris attempts to emulate his achievement in a three-way showdown for the 2025 Formula One title in the final race of the season in Abu Dhabi.
There's a dilemma now. Do we tell people when they're out? Because I had a complaint yesterday, which is I was waiting to hear the highlights package and them all kept revealing what was happening.
Can I just say this is 2025? Right. Seriously? Really?
There we are.
Okay.
It's the official view of sport.
Yeah, you can write directly to Jonathan Ledger, not to us, by the way. Broadcasting House coming tomorrow. Let's hear from Paddy O'Connell.
Hello. Three care leavers join us to talk about their hopes for their first Christmas, making a life on their own. How to celebrate if you hate Christmas Day due to bad memories. Books created by artificial intelligence could make it onto bookshop shelves. We've created an opening paragraph using AI for you to judge if it's as excruciating as it sounds. We profile Lando Norris, the British driver lapping the opposition in Formula One, and we've all the Sunday news that's fit to print. We hope you can join us for BH tomorrow morning at 9 on BBC Sounds and here on BBC Radio 4.
Where else, Paddy? Thank you. Quick look at the weather now. Today will be largely cloudy, with just occasional brighter spells developing at times. It will be windy, with scattered showers moving in from the west. Some heavy.
The time is just come out to 25 to 8. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson, Justin Webb, and Lisa Costello is here with the news.
England and Scotland are waiting to learn more about their draw for next year's Men's Football World Cup, including when and where they'll play their matches. 48 nations are taking part in the expanded competition in the US, Canada and Mexico. England are set to open against Croatia, while Scotland will end their group games by facing Brazil. Officials from Washington and Kiev say that any real progress towards ending the war in Ukraine now hinges on Moscow showing a genuine commitment to long-term peace. A second day of talks in Florida has concluded with both countries agreeing a framework for post-war security and reviewing reconstruction plans. The Royal College of GPs says family doctors are increasingly having to strike a careful balance when patients seek a mental health diagnosis but don't meet the clinical criteria. Hundreds of GPs have told the BBC they believe such conditions are being overdiagnosed. However, the Royal College says it was equally important not to dismiss genuine mental health concerns as overdiagnosis, as it could discourage people from seeking help. Members of Congress in the United States have raised concerns about the agreement for Netflix to buy part of Warner Brothers. The $72 billion deal brings weeks of negotiations to a close, but could still face significant hurdles. Trans women will not be able to take part in the main session at next year's Labour Women's Conference. The party says the formal proceedings, including speeches and policy debates, will be limited to biological women. The Supreme Court ruled in April that the term woman in the Equality Act refers to biological sex. Documents have revealed that a lifestyle app backed by the former Duchess of York received more than £1 million of taxpayer funding despite never launching a product. The company, Vavouche, was founded in 2010 by Sarah Ferguson's friend Manuel Fernandez, and she once described herself as an ambassador for the company. Neither of them has commented.
Thank you for that. It is 23 minutes to 8. The COVID inquiry has spent a second week taking evidence on the impact of the pandemic on the economy. This week, the central focus on the various government interventions that came in, so the furlough scheme, obviously, but also money for charities and the arts sector as well. Thea Leggett, the BBC's international business correspondent, has been watching it all and is on the line now. Morning to you, Thea. Set the scene.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Nick. Yes, this is the ninth phase of the COVID inquiry, which has been going on, or at least the hearings have been going on since June 2023. And as you say, this time they're looking at the economic response to the pandemic. So the time when everything in the country was shutting down, when restaurants, bars, cafes were having to close, we were a few days before lockdown, people were very worried about their jobs, and we had support schemes coming in, like the furlough scheme, the CJRS, also the self-employment income support scheme. There were increases to certain benefits like universal credit and working tax credit. And what the inquiry's been looking at over the past week, really, is the internal workings of the Treasury and the Department of Work and Pensions while all of this was going on. Because what it's doing is it's looking at what worked, who slipped through the cracks because these support schemes didn't help everybody, and what can be learned from it. Because half of the point of the inquiry, really, is recommendations about how things could be done better in the future. So there's been a lot going on. We've been hearing from some of the people whose roles were very important, but you might not necessarily have seen in the papers or online, and also government ministers from Treasury, DWP and so on. Anyway, there's been a lot going on, as I say, and I've been watching it, so you don't have to.
In the spring of 2020, the COVID infection was ripping through the population. Hospitals were filling up with acute cases. And on the 20th of March, the government took radical action.
We are collectively telling cafes, pubs, bars and restaurants to close tonight as soon as they reasonably can.
As a full lockdown became inevitable, strenuous efforts were underway to prevent all of this causing economic carnage and millions being left unemployed.
The impact enormous for business and for workers who'll have nowhere to go.
Tens of thousands of
businesses. I'm going to be honest, I'm struggling to hold it together at the moment, and it's not going to just be me, it's going to be all of us.
Over the past week, the COVID inquiry's been hearing from some of the architects of the economic response to the pandemic.
The point of a furlough scheme, and they exist in just about every European country, is indeed manifold.
At the time, Dr. Tim Leunig was a key advisor to the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak. He was one of those behind the landmark coronavirus job retention scheme, better known as furlough. He told the inquiry's top lawyer, Richard Wright KC, that the scheme was designed to ensure a quick economic recovery, because in a lockdown, workers could be paid to stay at home rather than being made redundant. And that meant they could be brought back to work quickly.
So the example I give in my evidence is the cafe can be confident that it can hire its staff, but it can also be confident that the pastries will arrive because the company producing the pastries will have rehired their staff. And therefore the economy can restart much more quickly than if everybody is made redundant and firms have to start from ground zero.
With the Treasury having chosen a furlough scheme, much of the groundwork had to be done by the Revenue and Customs Authority, HMRC. And ultimately, something that might normally have taken a year was done in just 3 days.
Righty, could I call please Sir James Hara?
HMRC's former boss, Sir James Hara, admitted that meant compromises had been made.
Yes, at that time, I think speed of announcement and speed of implementation were key, because it was apparent that the pandemic was worsening and therefore we were facing a lockdown of the economy, but also employers were coming up against statutory deadlines for consulting on redundancies if they wished to make redundancies. So it was important that they could have certainty early and a scheme that was perhaps more elegant but would be delivered a month later was not going to be a success.
I do solemnly.
Sarah Elliott is the former head of the National Council for Voluntary Organisations.
That the evidence I shall give.
She told the inquiry how charities had been badly hit by a huge fall in income, just as their services were badly needed. And that meant furlough, for many of them, simply didn't work.
But the fundamental flaw with the scheme was that charities, unlike businesses, so I've used the example of a pub or a cinema, which could just close. Charities couldn't just close their doors. It's not in a charity's nature to close its doors when there is such increasing need in communities. And so charities were faced with the choice of furloughing their staff and protecting their organisation's financial health for the long term, or stepping up to meet the need in communities, which is what most organisations did.
That's not to say there wasn't some help available. There was £750 million worth announced in April 2020. It was warmly welcomed at the time. But with hindsight, Sarah Elliott told the hearing, the help was too little, too late.
It takes time to reduce the size of an organisation in terms of making staff redundant. And charity leaders were calling me on an almost daily basis, asking when support was coming, was support going to be announced, because they and their boards were facing impossible decisions. In the run-up to the £750 million being announced, we said the scheme needed to be three things. It needed to be substantial, swift and simple. And in my view, it fell short on all of those counts.
Over the next 2 weeks, the inquiry will hear from many more of those involved with the economic response to the pandemic, including the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, and the man who found himself at the heart of the economic storm, the former Chancellor, later Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak.
That was Theo Leggett reporting on the COVID inquiry.
And it's now 18 minutes to 8. What traditions, what customs and celebrations, what skills contribute to Britain's living heritage?
I'm Tara, also known as Stonewaller Girl. When I'm walling, it doesn't just feel like a job, it's more like a craft. I'm shaping the landscape with my own hands, using nothing but natural stone and skill. Every wall I've built is literally a piece of heritage that will last for centuries, and it's been there for centuries as well. What's better than being outside in the middle of nowhere with just nature and weather elements to battle with?
I'm Sebastian Wanless, chair-elect of the Royal Scottish Country Dance Society. For over a century, our society has championed and maintained this vibrant living tradition, an energetic blend of lively music, joyful movement, and rich cultural heritage. But Scottish country dancing is more than just steps and tunes. It is a uniquely social form of dancing that welcomes everyone, everywhere.
I'm Emma Baker, a hand weaver. I teach people to weave on rigid heather looms, and I also weave on a large floor loom to create handwoven scarves, snoods, and luxury accessories. Weaving is a traditional craft with skills that have been passed down through generations. It's a slow process, but it allows the hand weaver to create beautiful and unique fabrics. Weaving is classed as a heritage craft, and I believe it has real value today and has an important place in the future.
Well, there we are, the Today programme doing its bit to add to the new inventory of the UK's living heritage. Let's discuss what that is and why it's important with the Director of Policy and Evidence at Heritage England, Ian Morrison. Morning to you, Mr. Morrison. What's the point of this new inventory with entries like the ones we've just heard?
Morning, Nick, and thanks for having me on. Well, our heritage is a unique, it's probably our greatest national asset, actually. We underestimate the value that it provides to the country and to our people. So, I mean, you had dry stone walling on there. There are around 125,000 miles of dry stone walls in Britain, and that's enough to circle the world five times. And we have one of the oldest building stocks in the developed world, so more than a quarter of our existing buildings are over 100 years old. And it's an extraordinary resource, you know, as I said, our greatest national asset, but we really have to look after it.
Yeah, but write it all down. The hope is what? That government institutions, that we all see it as something to value and preserve?
Absolutely. So in order to look after our heritage, we need a really large and highly skilled sort of specialist workforce. So thatchers, stonemasons, plasterers, carpenters, product makers too, you know, people who make stained glass, slate tiles and so on. There are around about 200,000 people who are directly employed to look after our heritage, and they generate around £15 billion a year of economic activity each year for the country.
So if people are listening and they've got some particular custom or tradition in their village or their town or even their city, or if they say, well, I really want cheese rolling to be part of that, Morris dancing, steel bands, what do they do? Where do they go?
Yeah, well, there's a huge resource both on Historic England website and on the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. And the whole point is what we're trying to do is create an index of all of these wonderful traditions and the heritage of our places. You know, we have a heritage hub on our website that you can find out about the heritage of your local area, find out what's important, get involved, take a role in looking after it and caring for it, because, you know, ultimately it is what makes people happy about where they live. It creates an enormous amount of economic benefit for our country. So we need just to encourage people to find out about it, look after it, and take part.
Well, you've done just that. So thank you. Ian Morrison of Heritage England.
40 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker here in the studio this morning is the Reverend Canon Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell, Welland Garden City. Morning, Rob.
Good morning. Good morning to you both. Well, what does true generosity look like? It's a good question to ask today, as the church here in the West celebrates the feast of St. Nicholas. Now, not much is known about him, but we do know that he was a 4th century bishop of Myra in what is now modern-day Turkey. The stories and the myths and the legend about him gathered much later on over many centuries, and many agree that he was a generous man. He is said to have assisted families in difficulty, supported the vulnerable, but always quietly and without seeking any recognition or reward. Now, after this one, there are only 2 weekends before Christmas, and inevitably, many of us focus on what we might give to other people. And I'm not only talking about practical gifts. I didn't know, but if you did, it was on Tuesday that we had what's called Giving Tuesday, which followed hard on the heels of Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Now, Giving Tuesday is a global movement calling on everyone, and I quote the website, to give, collaborate and celebrate generosity. Now, theologically speaking, there's no shortage of advice in the Bible about what generosity looks like. Hebrew wisdom literature defines it as speaking up for the voiceless, as well as defending the rights of the poor and needy. This theme is later embraced by Jesus, who emphasises on more than one occasion that giving should be done quietly, without fuss or boasting. Even your left hand shouldn't know what your right hand is doing. This is God's way of giving. Pope Leo, whose first overseas visit as pontiff this week included a pilgrimage to Turkey, has already taken up Pope Francis's mantra. The church needs to be generous, alongside the poor, supporting the marginalised. And the Pope has already posed this question: do we follow the path of selfishness, thinking only of ourselves, or do we recognise everything as a gift from God to be used to build a more just and equitable world? As Advent deepens, today, St. Nicholas's Day, comes at exactly the right moment. And as I light the second Advent candle tomorrow, the question I'll be asking myself is, am I as generous as I can be? And not just in terms of money or goods, because even a small act of kindness can shine brighter in the life of someone else than you or I might ever know.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Rob Marshall. It brings us to 11 minutes to 8.
When your principal ally produces its national security policy, you could be forgiven for assuming that its toughest language would be reserved for the enemy, or enemies plural. But the new US national security policy doesn't have in its crosshairs Russia and China. It appears to have European governments in its sight. It proposes, quotes, cultivating resistance in Europe, and warns that the continent faces, quotes, civilization erasure from high migration and falling birth rates. Now, that's horrified some who fear that the Trump administration will now be promoting the rise of far-right parties in Europe. Amongst those who don't like what they're reading are Gerald Knaus, the chair of the European Stability Initiative, which focuses on a different approach to migration policy. Morning to you.
Good morning.
For those who haven't read it, what is it that worries you?
Well, it is especially the consistency with what we've heard from the vice president of the US earlier this year in Munich and from the president at the UN General Assembly, that the US considers European greatness an American problem and sees that greatness, which it wants to help restore, best restored by supporting what it calls patriotic European parties, cultivating resistance, that's the quote, within Europe to what it considers the current politics. And that is a very clear call. Here in Germany, nobody can misunderstand what it means, supporting the far-right extremist AfD, which is celebrating this strategy, and which, of course, is inspired by Trump, wants to destroy the European Union, is a Dexit party, sees itself allied to Putin, warns about Poland and European neighbors, and risks taking Europe back into its darkest past. So to see the American administration, the biggest ally Europe had since World War II, support radical extremist parties that European nations consider threats to their constitution, as here in Germany, is more than worrying. It's a real signal that one can't rely on what used to be the best friend European Democrats had for a long time.
Now, there's always a danger in the language that people use that it reflects their own political judgment. So whether people say extreme or far right or hard right or populist and so on. But it's worth noting for people who don't follow the politics of Germany that the AfD, by your own intelligence agencies, is designated as a threat to the constitution.
Yes, it's not my opinion. It's something that the institution set up with support by the Allies in the 1940s and then established when the Federal Republic was set up in 1949, they are supposed to monitor institutions that threaten the basic constitutional order, democracy, human rights in Germany. And the AfD has very openly said it wants a completely different Europe. And the leader of the AfD just recently said, and I think this should worry every small democracy in Europe, from Denmark down to Estonia, down to Greece. The leader of the AfD has recently said that Germany sees itself closer under his leadership to Putin than to Poland, that Poland could be a threat. And that's the sort of language we have forgotten in Europe, because European nations have learned to trust each other in the framework of a European Union that, again, is identified as a problem.
What's interesting about this, Mr. Knaus, I think what's particularly interesting is whether this is more than words. Sitting alongside me, my colleague Justin Webb here, who hosts the BBC's America Cast podcast. What's interesting is these words in this document, Justin, are very similar, as we were just hearing, to the Munich speech, also to that UN speech. But from what you see, is it more than words?
Yeah, I wonder what your view is on this, Mr. Klass, that what they would say if they were here, particularly J.D. Vance, is that what they're doing is standing up for a sort of civilized values that Europe has collectively lost touch with, and that sort of fundamental sense is expressed now in support for these parties, potential support for these parties. But actually there is something deeper as well, that they think Europeans aren't properly supporting themselves and their own civilization. And in a sense, they're trying to assist us. I think that is what they would at least claim.
Yes, I don't think there is anything hidden here. They talk about certain NATO members will become majority non-European in the very near future. Now, what does that mean? We know, because Trump has said it and J.D. Vance have said it. They think people like the mayor of London or many members of the German parliament, born here, German citizens, but of, let's say, Turkish origin, they are not European. It's the identitarian view of politics. And to say that this is a problem for the alliance, that basically racist views, the word race isn't used, but majority non-European is understood as being linked to the origin of people, not whether they are citizens. This is the view of far-right parties that promise in Germany, and one of the most prominent AfD politicians has done it openly, to make sure that millions, 20 million, Björn Höcke, an AfD leader, has written in a book, of people now living in Germany should be made to leave. I mean, this is politics, domestic European politics, that threatens to undermine all the values on which our democracy is based.
But do you think, I mean, that's a crucial point, isn't it? And they intervene in British domestic politics as well, and are very aware of things that happen in this country, things that are controversial in this country, particularly when it comes to freedom online, etc. Do you believe that they are going to make a difference?
Yes, because if the resources of US tech oligarchs, Elon Musk has been calling to vote for the AfD in Germany. He's written an op-ed saying only AfD can save Germany. So a party that will destroy the EU. If these resources are combined with the resources of the American state, embassies, it's already been told that embassies should support anti-migration parties across Europe. It's not just the lack of trust, because America is then undermining the current governments in Europe, that is a problem. It's that this is a philosophy that goes against everything on which European peace has been built.
In that context, Mr. Knaus, do you think the intervention by the European Commission, by Margrethe Vestager, the commissioner, against X, so threatening vast fines against Elon Musk and his, what used to be called Twitter platform, is that part of what is now a cultural, a political battle between Europe and the United States?
Well, it shouldn't be. The European Union is one of the biggest markets in the world, and it has rules, for example, on consumer protection. It has the right to regulate what kind of content, and what I see on X now is very often racist, openly racist content, what can be displayed, what can be made available to children, what rules apply. And if the European Union applies its own rules in its own market and then finds itself threatened from the US, we are not seeing a relationship between allies that respect each other's democracies. This is a major problem, and it also hints at the incentive. I mean, the big American tech companies don't want to be regulated. So not having a European Union that is a powerful regulator would be an advantage. Divide Europe, weaken it, And you start by hitting Germany, by supporting anti-EU parties in Germany.
Gerald Knaus, thank you very much indeed. Just interestingly, EU leaders are already beginning to react to this. Reuters just quoting the EU foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, saying the US is still our biggest ally. Quite interesting that she feels the need to point that out.
I'm Katie Razzle, the BBC's culture editor, and this is the story of a book.
It's a wonderful book. She's an immensely talented and immensely valuable writer.
Award-winning, commercially and critically successful, then cancelled.
It just infuriates me. You're reinforcing stereotypes.
I remember feeling sick by page 8, maybe.
A culture war about race, class and who has the right to say what.
I do not think that I wrote in any way a racist book.
6 episodes, considering different perspectives. Anatomy of a Cancellation, from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Well, we will listen now to Sarah Keith-Lucas, who can tell us what the weather's got in store for us.
Thank you, Nick. Well, things are looking very unsettled through the rest of the weekend. Low pressure is firmly in the driving seat at the moment, so bringing more rain at times and some strong winds around today, especially in the south and the far northeast as well. So let's start with the detail across the southern half of the UK. So we're looking at all of southern England through Wales, the Midlands, into eastern England as well. Plenty of showers here from the word go, and they're really going to be hit and miss throughout the day. Most frequent for Wales and western parts of England, but we'll see some heavy ones getting their way towards the east as well, blown through on those brisk west or southwesterly winds. And with the big winds, they are making some large waves around the coast. So there's flood warnings around the south coast of England, through the Bristol Channel, into the southwest of Wales as well. So you might well see some coastal overtopping. Do take care around the coast today with the strong winds and big waves. Mild though, 11 to 13 degrees. Here and the showers just gradually easing into the evening hours. For Northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, lots of showers around here too, so certainly a day for the brolly. It's going to be windy in the northeast of Scotland all day, but the winds elsewhere fairly light actually, so the showers are going to be quite slow moving across this part of the world, but they will ease later and there'll be a few brighter intervals developing in between any of those showers. Temperatures in the north around 8 to 11 degrees. Then overnight tonight, most of the showers clear away, the winds ease. We could see some locally dense fog patches, especially northern England and parts of Scotland as well. Tomorrow, a dry, mild start for most of us, but rain in the south to start the day tomorrow will work northwards and eastwards across all areas throughout the day.
Helen, thank you very much for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It is 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 6th of December. The headlines this morning. The draw has been carried out for the biggest World Cup in history. Now England and Scotland are waiting for details of where they'll play. The blockbuster deal between Netflix and Warner Brothers is facing criticism in both Hollywood and Washington. Next, we'll get the perspective from the US and here in the UK with the BAFTA award-winning director Peter Kosminski. And a BBC investigation has found that driving instructors are being offered hundreds of pounds by touts who resell driving tests.
Also coming up, we'll be looking at the week's big stories with Lord Gove and Tom McTague. And we return to what was the country's least used railway station. We're hoping to find more passengers than we did when we visited last year. No one left and no one came on the bare platform, etc., etc.
I'm Jonathan Ledyard with your Saturday Sport. England's resolve to regain the Ashes is being tested to the full as Australia's first innings lead grows to 176 in Brisbane. And Lando Norris knows the feeling in a three-way showdown for the Formula One world title.
It obviously makes our life hard as a team because we have two drivers fighting for a championship instead of one. And that also has its complications at times and it allows for other parties to enter the chat more often. But yeah, we're so happy that we're both up there.
We're live at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix in the next half hour.
All that's after the BBC News read for us this morning by Lisa Costello.
England and Scotland will find out more today about their draw for the Men's World Cup next year and where they'll play their matches. The tournament will be the biggest in the competition's history, with 48 nations taking part. In a glitzy event in Washington, D.C. last night, England were drawn in a group with Croatia, Ghana and Panama. Scotland, making their first World Cup appearance since 1998, will face Brazil, Morocco and Haiti. From Washington, here's our sports editor, Dan Roan.
As well as being handed challenging draws, both England and Scotland know they'll be playing games in the east of North America, Which host cities and at precisely what times will be revealed by FIFA at a scheduling announcement later today, but the choices could be crucial. Teams playing in that part of the United States during last summer's Club World Cup faced extreme heat and storm delays, and that, along with the wishes of broadcasters, will determine kick-off times. If they win their group, England could face the daunting prospect of Mexico in Mexico City in the round of 16, and then a mouth-watering match against five-time winners Brazil in the quarter-final of an expanded tournament featuring 104 matches across 16 cities.
Officials from Washington and Kiev say real progress towards ending the war in Ukraine depends on Moscow showing serious commitment to long-term peace. A second day of talks in Florida has ended with the US and Ukraine agreeing to a framework for post-war security and reviewing recovery projects. They'll meet again later today. Our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports.
Talks about the latest US proposals on the Ukraine war have now stretched across 2 weeks and multiple venues. After a meeting in Florida, Mr. Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff posted an update to X in which he said Ukraine had reaffirmed its position that any settlement must respect its independence and sovereignty. The State Department said talks between Mr. Witkoff, Mr. Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and Ukraine's Rustem Umerov had agreed the framework of security arrangements. But the party said real progress would depend on Russia's readiness to show commitment to long-term peace. A Kremlin aide has said negotiations between Russia and the US are making progress and mentioned the possibilities of another face-to-face meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin. Talks between Ukrainian and US negotiators will reconvene today in Miami.
The Royal College of GPs says family doctors are having to strike a difficult balance when patients expect a diagnosis for mental health conditions but don't meet the criteria. Hundreds of GPs have told the BBC they think such conditions are being overdiagnosed. Of 752 who replied to a request, 442 said that on balance that was a concern. 81 said the opposite. The government has launched an independent review into mental health, autism and ADHD services. Dr. Adrian Hayter from the Royal College of GPs told us diagnosing was complex.
The system at the moment is quite stretched. Patients with conditions which are sometimes difficult to diagnose. Sometimes a diagnosis takes a bit of time for a diagnosis of a mental health disorder are not always going to get that full assessment right at that particular time.
Members of Congress have expressed concern about the proposed takeover by Netflix of Warner Brothers streaming and studio business. Writers' unions in Hollywood have called for the $72 billion deal to be blocked. It still needs approval and there may be obstacles in its way. Our North America business correspondent Samira Hossein reports from New York.
It took just hours for lawmakers in Washington to raise the alarm about the potential merger, saying it could force Americans to pay more for streaming services and give them less choice about how they watch. The other hurdle could come from the White House. Paramount Skydance, another company also bidding for Warner Brothers, has called the deal unfair and has reportedly taken its complaints directly to the commander-in-chief. Donald Trump loves deal-making and would normally be amenable to this kind of merger. He also needs to keep his donors happy. Paramount boss David Ellison is the son of Larry Ellison, a big Republican donor and a Trump supporter who has invested heavily in a number of the president's key economic projects.
Trans women will not be allowed to take part in the main session at next year's Labour Women's Conference. The formal proceedings, which include speeches in the main conference hall and debates on policy, will be restricted to biological women only. Our political correspondent Helen Catt reports.
Labour Women's Conference usually happens the day before the party's main annual gathering. This year it was cancelled following legal advice in the wake of April's Supreme Court ruling on the Equality Act. Labour has confirmed the conference will return in 2026, but it's understood that trans women will not be allowed in the main hall to take part in debates or votes or listen to keynote speeches. Instead, they will be restricted to fringe events, which will be open to everyone regardless of their sex. A spokesperson for the Labour Party said there had been a comprehensive legal review and that holding the conference in 2026 reflected its commitment to addressing the underrepresentation of women in the party and compliance with the law.
A BBC investigation has found that driving instructors across England are being offered up to £250 a month to hand over their official test booking login details to touts. The touts are then bulk booking driving tests and selling the slots to learners on social media. NJ Convery reports.
There are currently well over 500,000 learner drivers in Great Britain waiting to take their test. 21-week delays have led many to turn to third-party resellers, paying hundreds for a booking which should cost no more than £75. We have identified touts operating in London, Birmingham, Manchester and the home counties. Posing as driving instructors, we approached them and were offered monthly payments in exchange for access to the DVSA's driving instructor test booking system. The resale of test slots has been reported before, but this is the first time that driving instructors have been implicated in these schemes. We put our findings to the DVSA. They told us they do not comment on individual complaints, but added that any instructors who are involved may be investigated. New rules are expected in the spring, meaning only learners can book tests.
The director of music at Bangor Cathedral has been sacked after what's been called an inappropriate song was sung by choristers during a service in August. Disciplinary action was taken against Joe Cooper for the incident, which was a protest about cuts to the cathedral's workforce. Mr. Cooper says his sacking is extremely disappointing. Bangor Cathedral thanked him for his contribution to its music and life. A trial of a novel technique to treat prostate cancer, which could mean men face a lower risk of harmful side effects, has launched in the UK. Aquablation involves using a robot-assisted high-pressure water jet to remove cancerous tissue while avoiding surrounding nerves and muscles, which current treatment can affect. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes reports.
The main surgical method used to treat a diagnosis of prostate cancer is what's known as a radical prostatectomy, which sees the entire prostate gland removed. But this can leave men facing some distressing side effects. This new technique, aquablation, combines robot technology with very high-pressure water jets to remove cancerous tissue in and around the prostate, but without damaging the nerves and muscles that are associated with bladder control or the ability to get and maintain an erection. It's already being used in some NHS hospitals, but now four UK centres are taking part in a global trial of aquablation.
The celebrated architect Frank Gehry, who's best known for designing the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, has died at the age of 96. He used industrial materials and created bold designs using unconventional shapes, but he insisted he was a simple maker of buildings. He also designed the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles and won a string of awards. Paul Goldberger wrote Frank Gehry's biography and knew him well.
He's one of the very few architects of our time who has been able to engage people emotionally. He knew that a lot of modern architecture was kind of cold and sterile. He didn't want to do that, but neither did he want to go back into literally copying history the way some other architects have done. He wanted to keep moving forward.
Cricket and Australia are tightening their grip on the second Ashes test in Brisbane. In reply to the tourists' first innings total of 334, Australia were all out for 511, a lead of 177. Australia already lead the five-test series 1-0.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. The crown jewels are about to be stolen, or at least bought. These crown jewels.
Red, you go. Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
Now, funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you. I make you laugh.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard.
Oh, that was Gone with the Wind, of course. Streetcar Named Desire, Goodfellas and Harry Potter finishing up. To be heard in the future after this familiar sound. And in case that isn't familiar to you, that is the sound of Netflix. Netflix now buying Warner Brothers, which has the rights to all those classic films. You might think it's just another big business deal, but you would be wrong. It is potentially so much more than that. There are moments in our cultural life which underline that everything is changing or has changed. And a few years ago, the boss of Warner Brothers, the parent company at least of Warner Brothers, said of the idea that Netflix could dominate the industry, is the Albanian army going to take over the world? I don't think so. Well, They haven't yet taken over, but the Albanian army is, it seems, at the door with potentially huge consequences. Dominic Patton is executive editor at Deadline, which is the website that covers entertainment, Hollywood, media news. We began with some words of caution, the hurdles that might still stop the final takeover from happening.
We are not, my friend, talking about something that is at all a done deal. There are a number of hurdles that have to go here. Now, one of them is something that some people misunderstand. Here in the United States, we have the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. Normally, in a case like this, they would be involved, but they have no role here because neither Netflix nor Warner Brothers streaming services, studio, or HBO own a broadcast network in the United States. So that means they have no jurisdiction. Where the jurisdiction could come in? Oddly enough, on a bipartisan level, already Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren, who are about as left as you can get in mainstream American politics, they are asking the Donald Trump Justice Department to begin an investigation into this merger under antitrust laws, which means a monopoly. That could definitely make this take a while. The other thing that can make it take a while is, oddly enough, the European Union, which has actually a number of restrictions and regulations of its own, especially if you're a global streamer like Netflix and to some lesser degree HBO Max. The third thing that can happen here is Paramount, which is owned by David Ellison, who is the son of the second richest man, depending on what time of day it is in the world, Larry Ellison, the founder of Oracle, they could sue to say that this has been a rigged process, an unfair process, which they have pretty much alluded to in two letters they sent to Warner Brothers this week. They could also overbid, which means they could offer an exorbitant amount of money above what Netflix are offering, hoping that they could get shareholders to turn on the actual board decision themselves. The last thing that could happen here that really could hold this up, already in California, the state attorney general here has said that he does not want to do anything that he would see as being not of benefit to consumers. So one company having such a vast hold on the industry and therefore able to set prices both internally and externally, that could be seen as that.
If it goes ahead, what is the global impact?
Massive. I mean, over in the UK, you'll already start to see changes in prices, changes in content, changes in licensing, changing in availability of content. There'll be a big change. And you might actually see some changes in accessibility, depending on what can actually be licensed for the UK market.
What about news, finally? Because one of the things that isn't part of the deal, is it, is CNN, currently at Warner, owned by Warner. What happens to CNN, do you think?
Netflix has only gone for the streaming portion of this. They've only gone for HBO Max. They've only gone for the studio, and they've only gone for HBO. But news has never been a part of the Netflix ecosystem. But then again, up until yesterday, owning a giant studio was not part of the Netflix ecosystem.
But just to be clear about CNN's future then, because again, you think of what a brand it was, and I'm thinking back to, I suppose, the 80s and the 90s, when it was created, when it became this huge, globally important news brand. It's not over, you're saying?
CNN as a brand has great prestige. CNN as a brand is losing its viewership, it's losing market value, and that's something that's going to have to be part of its reinvention. Unfortunately, they really did miss the boat on digital, which is something you can't say of the BBC, for instance. Maybe they can recapture that. But in America right now, you have almost more news stations than you have members of Congress. And then, of course, go online and everybody's a news station if they have themselves a microphone. So how much of that you can grasp over time, the long game does not look good.
Dominic Patton, thank you very much for talking to us.
And listening to that live, Peter Kaminsky, the BAFTA Award director behind, of course, many productions, including the BBC's Wolf Hall. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What does it mean for us in Britain?
Well, there's an inevitability to all this, I think. You know, it's a bit, you can't stand against the tide. If you look back to 2022, you know, it was Discovery was the new beast on the block. It was this cable TV invention that had this novel idea of, you know, having a channel just devoted to documentaries. And then Warner Brothers snuffled it up. And here we are, 3 or 4 years later, with Warner Brothers being potentially gobbled up by the new big beast on the block, which is the most successful streaming service, Netflix. So I think there's an inevitability to it. But in terms of how it will impact on viewers and also how it impacts on our industry, you know, which is a big net earner for the UK Treasury, there'll be a reduction in the different number of taste centres. And what I mean by that is if you're a programme maker and you've got an idea and you want to offer it and it doesn't get accepted at the first or second place, there are you need a number of different places with commissioners who have different tastes where you can offer your ideas. And I think there'll just be less space for, as somebody said, odd, brilliant ideas. You know, we've seen this before. ITV used to be made up of 15 different regional companies. That was 15 different taste centres. Then it all got merged into one ITV, and you sort of end up with a thinner diet of the same familiar dishes.
Do you end up with a more American diet as well? In other words, stories that particularly appeal in Britain, things that are particularly British, just have less money potentially behind them?
Well, I think this is the wider concern that's been prompted by the rise of Netflix and Amazon and Disney Plus, and will only be exacerbated by increasing power of Netflix, which will have many advantages for the UK audience, by the way, and let's not ignore that. But there are certain types of programmes that a Netflix or an Amazon or a Disney Plus will not make, because primarily they're concerned with serving the American audience. They have an eye to what goes on over here, but primarily they're serving the American audience. So they'll make something like Adolescence, yes, which is a fantastic show, but it was about violence in schools. And as we know, you know, violence in schools was kind of invented in America. But they won't make Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, because they just don't have a postal system like that in America. And that's a story that had a huge impact. You did quite a lot about it on your show. That won't get made in a Netflix-dominated world where companies like the BBC and ITV and Channel 4 can't get their stuff made. So, yes, this is not good news for a plurality of different tastes, plurality of different, often weird, often very British, often slightly off-the-wall ideas.
Can British broadcasters fight back, as it were? Is there a possibility that we build in this country our own centre for streaming that allows British values, British interests to be reflected to British audiences?
Yes. The clear answer to that, Justin, is yes. But it requires an intervention from the government, and it requires a degree of governmental bravery that has been signally missing recently, because the streamers need to be levied. We need to take a levy from the subscriptions that they charge. And make no mistake, the likelihood is that the amount you pay for Netflix is going to increase. You know, that the Writers Guild in America said that this will eliminate jobs, push down wages, raise prices for consumers, and reduce the volume and diversity of content for all viewers. And the key point there is raise prices for consumers. So, you know, it already costs quite a lot to have Netflix in your home, I know, because I do it, as do many members of your audience. That's going to increase to pay for this $83 billion purchase, assuming it gets through antitrust legislation. And the result of that is there's this massive amount of money for program making going straight to California. Decisions about what we watch in the UK being made entirely in California. The way to address that in the way you're describing is to take it for the British government to take a levy off the subscription that we all pay and use that as a fund to help promote British programming, the kind of things that they don't make over there.
I've heard that suggested before. Is it getting anywhere? Has it got anywhere? Does the current Media and Culture Secretary ever say anything about it? Is it a live discussion, or are you simply bringing it up again in the hope that it might become one?
It was a live discussion until we talk about unexpected developments. And of course, the idea of Netflix taking over Warner Brothers Discovery is quite an unexpected development. The Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport was in India and suddenly, completely without apparent provocation, announced that there would be no levies on the streamers. And we didn't understand why until later that same week the British government announced their trade deal with America. And you could see that obviously there was a bit of a quid pro quo here. So no, there is absolutely no sign that politicians have got the guts to stand up to the bully in the White House and say, never mind, we're going to put the interests of British viewers first and levy the streamers. And that's the way to keep British broadcasters in the game here.
And just a final thought. You said that there are going to be some advantages for British consumers as well, which are what?
Well, Netflix makes some fantastic programs, Justin. The difficulty when you make these kind of arguments is you're sort of like this grim naysayer, and it's as if, you know, a plague on all their houses. The truth is, Netflix has improved, and the others that have sort of been struggling along in its wake, has improved the broadcasting firmament dramatically in the last few years. But I'm concerned as a program maker who's been trying to flog my wares for the best part of 40 years now, you need to have a number of different places where you can go if you've got an idea. And sometimes ideas are a bit weird, but then turn into something extraordinary and wonderful. You have to be able to find someone in the whole broadcasting world who's prepared to say, you know what, let's take a punt on that. And the fewer places there are that you can go, the less chance you have of finding someone who's a bit out of the mainstream and prepared to take a punt. And this kind of process just reduces those options.
Just a final thought. We've been discussing and talking almost entirely about what happens on people's television screens or wherever they stream onto whatever device they're looking at. What about cinemas?
Well, that's the other big worry. And James Cameron, one of the world's leading directors, is already on record as saying, you know, this is deeply worrying because, you know, if you're one of the big directors of the world, Denis Villeneuve, people like that, you want your material on the big screen. And Warner Brothers has got, you know, 100-year-plus incredibly honourable tradition of bringing movies to the big screen for an extraordinary family experience. Warner Brothers' primary focus, they do a lot of other things, but their primary focus is the cinema. Netflix tradition is to put things in cinema for the briefest time possible to qualify for Oscar consideration and then put it on their streaming network because that's what they're there to do. That's how they make their money. And I think all directors, particularly those who aspire to have their work seen on the biggest screen available, will be worried that this will lead to fewer cinemas, a reduced choice of what you can see on the cinema screen, and more material going straight to television.
Peter Kosminski, BAFTA award-winning director, including, as I was saying, the BBC's Wolf Hall. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It's 25 minutes past eight now. It's been a good week, an important week for Vladimir Putin. He's had a warm welcome in Delhi, and the new US national security strategy we were discussing earlier in the programme presents Russia as no longer a threat. Well, following Vladimir Putin on his travels, as always, is our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, and he sent us an essay with his thoughts about a Kremlin leader who is looking and sounding increasingly confident.
This year, more than any other, I've travelled the world reporting on Vladimir Putin and watching him grow increasingly confident and uncompromising. In March, I was in Murmansk, north of the Arctic Circle, and there I witnessed firsthand the Russian president courting the United States. Instead of criticising Donald Trump for his idea to acquire Greenland, President Putin had turned the other cheek. Nothing to do with us, he'd remarked. His investment envoy, Kirill Dmitriev, told me there were great opportunities for US-Russian cooperation in the Arctic and beyond. It was clear then that Russia hoped to lure the United States on side by dangling gold-plated carrots of economic cooperation. In August, I flew to Alaska, where Donald Trump rolled out the red carpet for Vladimir Putin, expecting him to end Russia's war in Ukraine. He didn't. he wouldn't sign up to a ceasefire. And as Russian troops seized more territory in eastern Ukraine, Vladimir Putin's tone became more and more defiant. In September, in Vladivostok, I listened as he laid out red lines. They were clearly directed at European leaders who were discussing the idea of sending peacekeepers. Any foreign troops deployed to Ukraine, he said, would be legitimate targets for Russia. And this week, I'm in India, where I've been reporting on Vladimir Putin's state visit. He will have loved the reception he got here. The Russian media certainly did. The ultra-pro-Kremlin Komsomolskaya Pravda news site ran this headline. A cavalcade, gun salutes and a marble throne room. How Vladimir Putin was greeted in an Indian palace with 340 rooms and 37 fountains. The leader the West had tried to isolate for waging war in Ukraine, treated here not as a pariah, but as a partner and an honoured guest. Posters had been put up around Delhi with President Putin's portrait and the words, "Welcome, Your Excellency, President Putin." It is a reminder that despite its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russia has powerful allies who are willing to sit down at the table with and do business with Vladimir Putin. And Russia and India are doing a lot of business. The two countries signed a raft of agreements on everything from pharmaceuticals to fertilizer, science to shipping. What's more, Mr. Putin said he was ready to ensure uninterrupted supplies of Russian oil to India, despite President Trump demanding that India stop purchasing Russian energy. And what about the war in Ukraine? An increasingly confident Kremlin clearly feels under no pressure to make concessions. What's more, it continues to construct a parallel reality around what is happening. Our special military operation, President Putin told Indian TV, is an attempt to end a war the West ignited with Ukrainian nationalists. In other words, Russia, the country that invaded Ukraine, that is waging war on Ukraine, is the victim, not the aggressor.
That was Steve Rosenberg talking to us from India. The time is 29 minutes past 8 to Jonathan on the sport.
Morning again. Nobody said regaining the Ashes was going to be easy, but currently it feels like climbing a mountain in flip-flops, because England eventually dismissed Australia for 511 on the third day of the second test, with every home batsman making double figures. That's a first innings deficit for England of 177. Henry Moran in Brisbane can tell us how England are faring in their second innings.
Well, that deficit has reduced to 159. England 18 without loss early on in this second innings, but it's gone every way Australia would have wanted today. They've got the new ball underneath the floodlights this dangerous time of day where it's so hard to bat, and England will feel if they can get through this session they at least will have a foothold in the game. But the deficit is vast, and it is going to be such a challenge to escape from this game with a draw. I think a win is out of the window, and a reminder, only one side in the game's history has come back from 2-0 down in an Ashes series to win, and that was Don Bradman's Australia in 1937.
We believe, hashtag, sort of. Test match special continues on BBC Sound. So England's cricket is up against it. What are the chances of Britain's Lando Norris coming out on top as Formula One world champion in the final race of the season? Well, he's one of three drivers involved in another gripping title showdown. Leads Max Verstappen by 12 points. His McLaren teammate Oscar Piastri by 16. Let's talk to the 1996 world champion Damon Hill, who rose to a similar challenge to take his crown, and he's waiting to talk to us in the pit lane in Abu Dhabi. Good morning, or even for you, good afternoon.
Well, in middle of the day, Jonathan, yes, absolutely right. Can I borrow your mountaineering metaphor, which is we've got a situation where we've got two drivers in contention near the top of Everest, and the other guy started at base camp, but they're halfway up, and he's caught them up, and we've now got a three-way attack on the summit. So you need to have a calculator with you. There's a very simple solution to understanding how it can be won by Lando, and that is if he finishes ahead of the other two, then he's going to be world champion, so that's good. But otherwise, you need to understand Fermat's last theorem, I think, to be able to calculate it.
So how did you approach the decider knowing what was at stake? Because you did it going to the final race with a 9-point lead over your teammate.
Yes, it's nice to have a lead. I mean, Lando's got 12 points, so I think 16 over Oscar, or 12 on Max, but you know, anything can happen, as we know. And these things tend to be not so straightforward when it comes down to the last race. I think you just have to come at this race with the intention of having to win it. That solves all the problems.
What have we learned so far from practice? How close could this be?
Well, we learn from practices before when things can seem quite good on a Friday, and then things can start to crumble. I mean, particularly Lando has shown that he might be a little bit vulnerable when it comes to the pressurised last run, which could be all important. There will be nothing in it between the guys going for the front row. And, you know, when I say nothing, I mean, there's a lot of front rows and pole positions have been decided by thousandths of a second this year. And it is so how you go a thousandth of a second quicker, I don't know. It could be down to whether or not you have a banana before you get in the car.
Okay, then. But now, one key fact is that Norris and Piastri are trying to win their first title. Max Verstappen is trying to make it five in a row. What difference does that make?
I thought, well, he's relaxed. He's totally relaxed. He's got nothing to lose. He's already, you know, where he is in the championship, and he's got four in the bag. So this is all just fun. That's the way he's been talking about it. I think Oscar is a little bit more crestfallen. He'll be buoyed a little bit by the cricket performance in Australia, but he feels a little bit, and there's some sort of discussion as to whether or not he's been hard done by McLaren. McLaren attempts to be fair. In actual fact, I think McLaren have tried very hard to be fair, but it's just turned out that we have a situation now where Max has caught up, and that's rather complicated things for Zak Brown at McLaren, whether or not he has to instigate some sort of discussion as the race progresses, depending on who's where.
Have you got a name out of those three, then, you reckon, who's going to do it? Norris, Verstappen, Piastri?
I think Norris, he could become the 11th British world champion, so I'm obviously very, very... I'd be delighted for him if he managed to achieve that, but I would very much, he's got the advantage, he's got more points, so I'm going to say he's still got a better chance than anyone else right now.
Go well, thank you very much indeed, Damon. Damon will be part of the Five Live commentary team. Final practice before qualifying starts in 2 hours. Norris is going to win the title, as he said, if he finishes on the podium regardless of anyone else's results. Commentary on Five Live Sports Extra Sportline. What a day.
Yeah, exciting. Saturday Live coming up as well. Let's hear from Adrian Charles.
Hello, good morning to you. Our three guests today have all overcome formidable obstacles. We've got the brilliant Chris McCausland, amazing comedian, extremely clever, and, of course, an excellent dancer. We've also got Douglas Robertson. Now, he survived being cast adrift in the Pacific for 38 days after an altercation with a killer whale. Live to tell the tale, and quite literally a surmounter of obstacles, Mia Stanzani, a record-holding obstacle course racer. All that and some pigeon fancying, as well as the inheritance tax of Jacinda Ardern. That's all coming up from 9 o'clock.
Adrian, thanks for that. The weather is going to be largely cloudy today. Occasional brighter spells developing at times. It will be windy, though, particularly in the evening. Scattered showers moving in from the west, some of them heavy.
It's now 25 tonight. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson. And Lisa Costello has a summary of the news for us.
More details of the match schedule for next year's Men's Football World Cup will be set out today after England and Scotland learned who they'll be facing. England are grouped with Croatia, Ghana and Panama, while Scotland will take on Brazil, Morocco and Haiti. Officials from Washington and Kiev say any real progress towards ending the war in Ukraine now hinges on Moscow. They called for a genuine commitment to long-term peace. The Royal College of GPs says family doctors are increasingly having to strike a careful balance when patients seek a mental health diagnosis but don't meet the clinical criteria. Hundreds of GPs have told the BBC they believe such conditions are being over-diagnosed. Members of Congress have raised concerns about Netflix's agreement to buy part of Warner Brothers. The BAFTA-winning director, Peter Kosminski, told us the deal was not good news for slightly off-the-wall British ideas, saying he believes there are some programmes Netflix will not commission because it's primarily serving the American audience.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It's now 24 minutes to nine. It being a Saturday, there's a moment to take a breath, to pause, to reflect on some of the more interesting things that happened in the week that just passed, but maybe didn't quite make into the headlines, or things that we should keep an eye on are going to matter in many weeks, many months' time. And here to help us do it in the studio, the editors of the country's two big political weeklies. On the right, Lord Gove. Michael Gove is here, editor of The Spectator magazine. On the left, the editor of The New Statesman, Tom McTague. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Morning.
Let us begin with Europe, Michael, a cause close to your heart. Do you feel, as one of the leading Brexiteers, that maybe those comments by the Deputy Prime Minister hinting that Labour may want to take not just a step but a stride closer to Brussels will change the politics of this conversation?
I think it is a sign of a change. I think that there are a number of people on the progressive left who think that doing more than they've done so far in re-establishing relations with Europe can act as a sort of electoral Viagra, that the scattered forces of the progressive left, some of which are clustered around Zach Polanski and the Greens, some of which, of course, have moved to the Liberal Democrats, can all be brought back under one banner, and that there is nothing so exciting for progressive voices across all of these parties, nothing so uniting as the idea that we can overturn what they see as the historic crime of Brexit. I think that there are formidable political and economic problems for any government that's seeking to move towards rejoining the EU. And I think in particular, the invocation of the customs union is economically illiterate because to rejoin the customs union, you have to accept a common external tariff. And that means that the trade deals with America and India that the government are so proud of would have to go in the bin.
Tom, let's begin with the politics, then we'll go on to the policy. Is Michael Gove right that the temptation is on the left to find this sort of single unifying cause that can bring these disparate forces together?
Absolutely. I mean, and it is happening partly because of the political problems that the government is facing. So they need to galvanise their own supporters. They need to galvanise the country around something. They are giving up, it seems, on the idea that they can stick with the coalition that they assembled at the last election. So they need to find a new coalition. And part of the reason that the government is in such difficulty is they're losing supporters to the Lib Dems, to the Greens, and to others to their left. Now, this is what is going on now in British politics. We are seeing a polarisation on the right and the left and a kind of hollowing out of the old centre.
Now, David Lammy says that what he wants to do is look at the customs union, but stresses it wasn't in the manifesto. It's not going to happen now. What's your answer, Tom, to Michael Gove's policy objection, which is, it may sound all very well, but it involves reversing things that have already been done?
I mean, it's true. It's true. The problem is, though, the government can just simply say, well, we will negotiate. We will negotiate something better, because you don't just enter the EU's customs union. You negotiate a new customs union between the UK and the EU. The idea that you just kind of walk back to something that exists is not the case. So they have an argument that in response to Michael.
But maybe, Michael, it's a banner under which you unite. Yeah, sure. Otherwise, you don't need a practical series of policies and a manifesto. You just need to say, this is whose side I'm on.
Yeah, no, I think that is fair enough. I think that, as ever, the debate on Britain's relationships with Europe operates on an emotional and an intellectual level. And on an emotional level, the idea that we should move far closer than we currently are does have that quickening of the pulse effect for a broad progressive coalition. But as Tom acknowledges, and as your question also hinted at, the EU itself is not going to say, oh, that's great, come on, back in, previous terms, everything's fine. We've seen, even in the relatively small steps that Nick Thomas-Simmons, a very capable negotiator on behalf of the government, I should add, has undertaken, that when it comes to a defence pact, when it comes to a youth mobility scheme, the EU has said, very interesting, you're interested, here are our terms, and they're much tougher.
And Tom, this fits into another big political story of the week, front page of the Telegraph today, the suggestion of a Streeting-Rayner pact, manoeuvring for the possibility of Keir Starmer being toppled as Prime Minister.
Yeah, they are completely connected. We are hearing these ideas coming out because there is a certain sense of a breakdown of order, of direction in this government. And we are seeing people freelance and saying what their arguments are. And we are starting to see positioning ahead of what looks increasingly like an inevitable leadership election next year, a leadership challenge.
Inevitable.
Oh, at the moment, it certainly looks like it. That's how people in the cabinet are talking about it. That's how most Labour MPs see it. So whether that happens or not, it is currently the standard conventional wisdom of Labour MPs and Labour cabinet ministers. We should stress that, cabinet ministers. They are expecting a challenge. They don't think this can go on any longer, and they are starting to position.
And the positioning in this case is presumably, because Wes Streeting can read the polls as much as anybody else, and he sees that this is in fact Ed Miliband who is ahead amongst Labour members. You're laughing, but he's way ahead, isn't he, in those polls?
Yes, he is. I don't think Ed Miliband would want to go for the leadership again, though he is undoubtedly very popular, and again, that's because he has a clear sense of mission in the role which he occupies as Energy Secretary. Wes Streeting did very well at the Labour Party conference by invoking Angela Rayner, praising her, and he's also on issues like Gaza tacked a little bit to the left in order to maximise his appeal. It's déjà vu for me. When I was a Tory cabinet minister, I could see that it was a sure sign of decline for prime ministers when you had this over-manoeuvring. But I think that Wes Streeting is mistaken if he thinks that Angela Rayner is going to play essentially the role of political girlfriend to his ambitions, because I actually think that Angela Rayner is in a better position than Wes Streeting to win any leadership election. And the idea that just because she's had the difficulties that she did over tax, that she's going to meekly accept Wes Streeting as her route back to respectability, I think she won't accept.
I don't think Wes Streeting thinks that, though, actually. I don't think he expects Angela Rayner just to sort of lie down or let him take the crown without something of a battle. I think they are all eyeing them each other quite carefully at the moment, and they are not taking each other's calls.
Now, there's this small matter at the moment of whether you run the country properly, isn't there, while we're discussing all this? And welfare reform is one of those issues that it looks as if the Labour Party did not think through, Tom, before getting to office, and are now desperately having to try and come up with some way of dealing with it. And this week we did see, again, Mr Streeting say what he admits he said off the top of his head, which is we're over-diagnosing mental health, and then had to write at The Guardian and say, oh, no, I didn't mean quite that, and I've launched a review. And it shows how delicate an issue it is. It
shows how delicate an issue, but also that we can get policy now because you say something off the top of your head. Now, we've also been in this...
He was asked, to be fair, question about it.
Yes, yeah. But it's not, to be fair, it's not a novel thing to get policy off the top of someone's head, I do remember.
Says a veteran of 14. Yes.
But we had this in education as well, where there was an attempt to look at SEND provision, and then we've had it in health.
Special education needs.
Educational needs. So this is something that the government is clearly looking at, but we don't have, and we had the Treasury, of course, trying to push through welfare reform previously, couldn't do it, which is why we ended up in the situation of the budget, where they had to raise taxes. This is a government that's fundamental problem is that there isn't a clear direction on these issues from the top that offers a kind of coherence which tying together all of these departments. So it the policy is kind of one minister says something, he launches a review, another minister says something else, and another minister says something else.
I think Tom is absolutely right. The government isn't like a single franchise with different people delivering all to an agreed formula. It's more like a farmer's market. Keir Starmer has lots of different sole traders all bidding for your attention. And I think the particular thing with Wes Streeting is that when he talked about overdiagnosis, he was right. But he felt he probably had to row back because of the sentimental and kind-hearted views of lots of Labour MPs.
It's an interesting one, that, isn't it? If they had that kind of overarching sense of purpose, etc., would it then make it easier for them to say difficult things to the various constituencies? You think of, you know, the whole over-diagnosis debate, to say difficult things to people because they can say as well, look, this is within the framework of what we are intending to do.
Totally. And the other thing, of course, is that Keir Starmer can't even stick to his own line, never mind defend anyone else's, as we saw over migration and indeed over welfare reform. So if you're a brave Labour cabinet minister, high agency figure, you push forward change, even if the Prime Minister has indicated that he's behind you, You can't be certain that he won't buckle under pressure.
Tom?
Well, I think it's ultimately because the Labour Parliamentary Party are the ones that are leading the government, in a sense, and saying, if we're not going to get the direction, we will set it for you. Now, they did that over welfare, and they said, look, we just do not accept that these are moral reforms. You're doing it for the wrong reason, and you're hurting the wrong people, so we will stop you doing that.
A quick final word, Michael Gove, because you have the joy now of editing your magazine, so you can highlight things you think we ought to be talking about more. And one that the Spectator magazine has done recently is defence.
Yes, so defence didn't feature in the budget, but it did feature, of course, when Rachel Reeves gave her spring statement. Keir Starmer has stressed that we're living in a more dangerous world. The revelations overnight, which you've been covering, of the White House's, of the US's own new national security strategy, emphasise that increasingly it is Europe alone from the point of view of the White House. And yet at the same time, the heads of the armed forces are saying not just that they can't fund the growth in the Strategic Defence Review, they may have to make cuts. All of the defence chiefs have communicated this to the Prime Minister, and it's at a time when the army is being hollowed out in other ways. I think that the state of our defences overall is the big unreported story of the moment.
But Tom, a final thought. By the sounds of it, you think Keir Starmer may have to prepare for his last Christmas in Downing Street?
Well, look, that's... I don't think he should be preparing for it. I think he should be preparing to get a grip and to lead. And if he does so, he can play on the fact that the Labour ministers are not going to allow a coronation. So there's going to be chaos, or he can get a grip. He should try and get a grip.
Tom McDaigh, editor of The New Statesman. Michael Gove, Lord Gove, editor of The Spectator. Thank you for coming in.
12 minutes to nine is the time. This was the week that saw the annual announcement of the least used stations in the country. Denton in Greater Manchester was the winner last year. Sadly, or perhaps happily, it is now the fourth least used. We sent our reporter last year, Katie Hasseldine, down to Denton to check if anyone was getting on the 0842 service.
The train is pulling in. Can you hear it? It's just one. It's two carriages. Okay, I'm looking on the train now. I'm walking past all the windows. There is not a single person on this train. Oh, wait, no, there is. I give him a little wave. He's looking at me like I'm a crazy person. And there he is, the train driver. No, there's nobody getting off, Sean. I kind of want to get on it just so that I can say that I've done it and tick it off a bucket list. It feels like such an exciting occasion.
Well, that's the kind of commentary that Katie is famous for, rightly. So we thought we'd do it all again. And she's there. Hello, Katie. What's happening?
Morning, Justin. Well, it's a strange atmosphere this morning at Denton Station. For those that haven't been here before, and we know there are a lot of people that haven't been
that's
to this
us,
station.
That's all of us,
let me just set the scene. Denton Station, it's tucked away next to the M67. You may be able to hear a bit of traffic behind me. There's just one platform. I'm walking down the steps that lead to it. Now, there's just two trains a week here, the 8:42 to Stockport and then the return to Staley Bridge at 9:15. Now, we were hoping for a bit of action today, given the good people of Tameside rallied together to almost double this station's activity in 2025. But I can exclusively reveal to you live on the Today programme, Justin, that the 8:42 train to Stockport has been cancelled. We believe, due to a member of the train crew being unavailable, I'm informed that there is a rail replacement bus running from the bus stop across the road at 8:55, but I've checked the bus stop, doesn't look like there's anybody there, so thankfully no disappointed passengers. In fact, no passengers at all. So, and for anyone that was planning on getting the 9:15 to Staley Bridge, I'm sorry to break it to you, but that is also cancelled. So we'll just have to keep coming back each year until we find someone.
Tell you what, Katie, are you only an expert on Denton, or can you tell us anything else about the other stations? Do say if you can't, but the other stations that are on this list.
I can't. I can only do Denton,
good.
I'm afraid.
That's good. That's the right answer. Katie, we're already looking forward to talking to you next year.
Me too.
I don't know what you do in the intervening period.
She stays there, doesn't she?
I just stay here, Justin.
Well, try to get home, I suppose. Nice to talk to you, Katie.
Yeah. I had rather assumed she was becoming the Denton correspondent now. Could spend the entire year sitting on the platform.
He does do it very well. Let's hope that Denton does still exist as a place. But anyway, as I say, actually, they have done better because on days when the trains do run, there is someone. Doesn't say here how many people are actually using it, but more people are using it than were. There we are.
It's 9 minutes to nine.
From our own correspondent is turning 70. It is a Radio 4 staple, of course, even in the age of podcasts and opinions available everywhere. It carries on in mild BBC form, judgments rather than opinions, we tell ourselves. A special programme is going to be broadcast tonight at 8 o'clock on BBC Radio 4, featuring our very own Anna Foster, alongside Lise Doucette, Kate Adey in her war reporter days, Jeremy Bowen as well. Sometimes the programme finds space for less illustrious names, including this fellow chuntering on about ending his time as North America editor in 2009.
You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. America was not designed to be left. The opposite, in fact. It was designed to be arrived in. It was programmed to receive. And as was the case in the Eagles Hotel California, there is some wonderment at the front desk when you try to go. For effect, I sometimes exaggerate our sadness at the end of our time in America. Result? Confusion. Our British home is in South London, so we'll probably all be murdered before Christmas. Oh my gosh, why not stay? Because you have no sense of humour, would be one answer, but it's not why we're leaving. In more than 7 years of life in America, I have come to value, to love, actually, the stolid, sunny, unchallenging, simple virtuousness of the American suburban psyche. The woman who is to sell our house is a prime specimen. She is perky. Nothing gets her down, not even the fact that we're selling in the midst of the biggest depression since the Great Flood. In this area, it's different. You have a lovely home, but she thinks we have too many books. She doesn't say so, but she talks of creating spaces on the shelves for snow globes, perhaps, or silver photo frames with perfect children showing off perfect teeth. This is a cultural thing. When selling a home in America, you have to pretend that you don't live there. No, you have to pretend that no one lives there, or ever has. Previously owned homes are, of course, the norm, but we Europeans, we understand that previous generations have made their mark. This means, as we English know, having grown up with rattling windows and mouldy grouting, that a home will be imperfect. They do not make such allowances in America. So the inspector's report, the survey, is the cause of much deliberation and soul-searching with our potential buyers. An outside light is not working properly. A tap is leaking. A chimney needs investigation. As I read it, my mind turns to our house in London, which is actually falling down. Somebody omitted to prop up the middle when an arch was cut in a downstairs room 100 years ago, but which is still eminently saleable. The English understand that we are all falling down. Dust to dust, we intuit. Americans don't. They haven't got there yet. Truth be told, I would rather be them than us. I admire the concern over the chimney and the belief that the problem can be fixed. I sit on the porch in the growing evening heat of the Washington spring, the cicadas chirruping and the sound of lawns being mowed, and yearn to be staying. It would be so easy, so uncomplicated, so safe.
He's very good, though. Whatever happened to him? I don't know, we should get him back sometime. No, all of that, tributes to... from our own correspondent at 70 on BBC Radio 4 tonight at 8, with all the folk we said, and also with Steve Rosenberg, our Moscow editor as well, by the way. Now, just a last word at 5 to, or coming up to 5 to 9, on communication. What is the key to great communication? Not just the words you used, as Justin so amply demonstrated a second ago, not just the voice you have, but your hand gestures. That, at least, is the theory in a new study that has been published in the Journal of Marketing Research, following the analysis by an academic, yes, they do these things, of thousands of TED Talks and controlled experiments to examine how gestures shape our communications. Well, let's talk to two experts. Judy James, a body language expert, author of the Body Language Bible. Gitto Harry, former political editor of GQ, correspondent here at the BBC, and Boris Johnson's communication chief when he was mayor of London. Morning to you both. Judy, how important, in your view, are the hands?
Well, they are important. I mean, it's always said that they help people understand or retain about 30% more of the information that's coming out of our mouths. But It does depend. So your gestures need to be firstly congruent, and that means that they're saying the same thing as your words are. When they're incongruent, you're like big liars. They also need to be illustrative or emphatic, so they'll actually help the communication. And unfortunately, because surveys like this come out, I end up coaching people that are then just waving their arms around wildly, thinking it will help. But that's called self-heckling, and you often see that with politicians. They're saying one thing and the hands are actually letting on that they don't believe their message.
You know, Harry, it's interesting because we all think, whether we love him or loathe him, that Boris Johnson was a great communicator, but I didn't particularly think of his gestures, of his hand movements. It's the language and the humour, isn't it, that mattered?
Well, words matter, so you've got to get them right, and he was quite a wordsmith. But yeah, if it's quite a tough one to illustrate on the radio by definition.
Yeah.
But if you were to speak with your hands completely still, maybe sitting on them, it's funny how your voice would follow. And it's one of the most striking things if you watch an actor, proper actor or actress, do a sort of voiceover where it doesn't matter what they look like, but their hands are moving all over the place because their voice does follow. And I think one of the things that people look out for, and it does go to Boris when he did have this extraordinary connection, is that people are comfortable in their own skin. And if they're comfortable in their own skin, then you feel sort of vaguely comfortable with them. And what other politicians fail to pull off is they look uncomfortable, which makes them look aloof, which is not good in politics, makes them look out of touch, a common sort of accusation. It makes them look arrogant, which is, you know, curtains, or it just makes them look shifty and you end up thinking they don't believe in anything. Does that remind you of anyone in politics today?
Judy James, I dodged that question. Judy James, it seems to me that sometimes when people are taught, and I'm sure you do it very well, but it looks taut. You can see people suddenly gesturing to a backdrop, for example, in a completely artificial way, waving their hand as if we don't know it's there. It can be awkward, can't it?
Absolutely. And there's an amazing giveaway as well that will be great fun when you're watching politicians from now onwards, which is authentic emotion, authentic feelings will mean that the gesture will come first, because it's easier to gesticulate your emotions than it is to create, to turn them into words. So when somebody's been taught, I would say, I'm going to say badly, you will often see that they'll speak their message and then their hands gesture will be a bit of an afterthought, because somebody's been standing there yelling at them, wave your hands when you say it, or, you know, turn it into a fist, do one of Tony Blair's sum of power gestures, but they come after the message, which shows that that's not really an authentic message.
I was struck, Gitta, I don't know if you were, that this study was done by someone born in Italy, now living in America, where a lot more hand gestures there.
They do. Well, and, you know, I speak a little Italian, and you have to commit to it. You've got to actually go with it. Interestingly, the gesture, you know, will come first, spot on there. And we all remember that really creepy smile that Gordon Brown did as an afterthought at the end of a long sentence. And then a little voice in his head said, you should smile now. It doesn't work. The thing that we all crave in our politicians, even if we turn against them down the line, is a sort of authenticity. And your body, you know, doesn't lie in the end. People can read that. And when it comes to the core of politics, it's less about policy. It's less about sort of manifestos. It's the art of persuasion.